Good morning, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. And because, of course, Jeff didn't do a live portion this morning, and things are a little bit different, I'm gonna do a little bit of what I did last week, a little bit more than I often do, and that is to kind of talk about some of the things that I went through. I'm gonna spend a lot more time though talking about the more current aspects of what I will suggest are the very same kinds of issues that are being brought up in this week's Torah portion than I often do on Friday night. So let's start with where the Torah portion starts. Shemot, Exodus, chapter 25. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, saying, "Speak unto the children of Israel," and here comes those unique words that define the name of the portion in the Hebrew, "that they take for me terumah, an offering." Sometimes you'll see it referred to as a heave offering. "Of every man whose heart makes him willing, you shall take my offering." And I think that's the key too today, and it's what I'm going to come back to on more than one occasion. This idea of where we are at the point where this is being done, the B'nai Israel, the people of Israel, are at a cusp, a turning point, a tipping point. Things are fixing to change. We've already seen in the last week's Torah portion that the nature of the narrative has changed. Up until the first couple of through the first couple of books of Scripture, we have stories. We have the story of the patriarchs and the creation in Genesis. Then we have the beginning of their descent into bondage with the story of Joseph. And then, of course, with the Exodus, the key is Ani Yahuwah. I am who I am. And here is, you know, my nature being revealed to you, the fact that I am a covenant keeper. And that's what you need to understand about me. And then he brings them out of bondage by a mighty hand. And then we get this this change in the narrative, where all of a sudden, now we're going to start talking about commandments, statutes, judgments, hukim, mitzvot, mishpatim in the Hebrew. The instruction up until now has consisted of more than just a list of commandments. It's been stories that help us to understand a whole lot of things about him and about what his creation is and where he needs us to be, wants us to be, why we were created, and what we're supposed to do. And now we start getting some more instruction about specifics, commandments. And then this time, in chapter 25, we're at this different cusp. "Take an offering," it begins. He tells us what kind of offering. All kinds of things. Gold, silver, brass, purple, blue, scarlet, fine linen, goat's hair, ram's skins, and various kinds of wood, primarily acacia wood, oil for the light, spices, stones to be set. And then all the reasons why show up in verse 8 and 9. "Let them make for me a sanctuary," mikdash, and it's going to be called the tabernacle, mishkan, "that I may dwell among them." And I mentioned this, some of the midrashim, some of the folks out there will say, when you look at this and when you actually understand it in a wider context, it really is saying, again, "that I may dwell among them," and this is to be done, if you will, on a continuing basis. And I like that interpretation, because I think, for reasons that we're going to talk about today, we have to do the same thing. We may not physically go out and build a tabernacle. You'll hear the teachings, and I don't have a real problem with this one, that say that, you know, the tabernacle is in us. I don't think that is nearly as important. This will sound somewhat heretical as we're coming out of the extant churches and so forth. But I think the real key here is that we need to make the offering of ourselves. People brought skills, by the way, to the table as well. We see that in here. And that it's about doing something constructive, building as opposed to destroying. And that to that extent, I do think every generation has to build again. Now, there's a lot of other things that come out of this concept of building, and I'm going to spend some time talking about that too. And then we're going to contrast that with the come out of her aspect of, well, what are we seeing today? What we're seeing today is the tearing down. We're seeing destruction. We're seeing the absolute opposite of anything that's being described in this portion. Indeed, we've seen that for a long time. Calling evil good and good evil. Turning Scripture on its head. He ain't welcome in the schools, the churches, the courthouses, certainly not in the White House or the halls of Congress. It's upside down. It's destruction. And the opposite, again, is to build. We need to be about the business of making an offering of ourselves to Him so that according to the pattern that He shows us, and there is some value to understanding the pattern, and for that reason alone, I would encourage everybody to go read through this and understand what's being said here. Now, let me ask a couple more questions to set this up today. This is something I probably say every year as well when we go through these next few Torah portions. To some extent, a lot of people say, well, Leviticus is hard. Leviticus is a whole bunch of rules. That's hard. I guess I think to some extent what we're seeing here is a little bit more difficult. It's more difficult for most people to understand the relevance of. Hey, we got people around here that joke about, hey, I won't use algebra. Why do I need algebra for? Well, and to the same extent, you could probably make a better case for the Mishkan than you can for algebra. Because it was only a temporary structure anyway. And it was a long time ago. What difference does it matter? Why is there so much detail about this? Especially if it's only going to be a temporary dwelling. And I guess, when I put it that way, a part of the answer becomes apparent. Because if you think about your body, take a look in a mirror, you too are a temporary dwelling. And nevertheless, I suspect to most of us, we'd say our body is important. We'd like to keep it properly constructed rather than deconstructing it and destroying it. And that, too, harkens to what's going on today. But there are other reasons that are perhaps even more important. And I'm going to lay out about three of them. I'll do this more quickly than I did last night, so let me encourage you again. If there are questions, I will certainly address those. And also, I'll point people to the fact that I spent a lot of time on some things that I'm going to go through more rapidly here today so that we can move on to some other aspects of it. And giving credit where credit is due, I'm going to put a bunch of pieces together from several articles, Midrashim, other things that I tend to look at. And there are a few folks, everybody has their favorites, lots and lots of things that I'll read every week. But it seems like over and over again, I tend to return to just two or three as being the ones that if there's something that's going to resonate with me personally, I'll pick from. And one of those is a guy that I have at least a couple of his articles sitting in front of me. Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sachs is his name. You've heard me quote this fellow before because, again, I do like what he says. Another one is a fellow, David Foreman, who wrote a book that I first read a number of years ago when I was doing some study on my own. And I thought, hey, this is fascinating. I wonder if I'm the first person to come up with this. Well, probably not. And I found a really great book that Rabbi David Foreman had written when I did some web searches online. And went and got his book, and I have been an admirer of his thought processes for a long time, too. The book, I forget. It has to do with Genesis and the pattern in Genesis, and I'll have to find the book. So if there's a question online, we'll come back to that. If we can. So let me lay out a couple of these concepts. One of them. This is something I've alluded to before, and certainly it's not probably not a shock to most of you, that there are a number of fundamental constants in the universe that really, had they been different, this is one of these easy arguments for why evolution is bogus and why there has to be a creator. And one of the fellows, the book in particular that gets referenced here is Just Six Numbers by Lord Rees, Royal Astronomer, later President of the Royal Society in Great Britain, one of the most prestigious scientific bodies in the world. And he wrote about how the fact is that the universe was, in fact, pretty well determined by these six mathematical constants. And had they varied by one part in 10 to the 6th or 10 to the 9th even, there would have been no life in the universe or maybe no universe at all. Things like the gravitational constant and any number of other fundamental aspects to the way physics works. In other words, the detail is important. The detail, again, as Scripture tells us, reveals the handiwork of the Creator. We can know Him by seeing, we can't know Him completely, but we can at least get an impression of Him by looking at the things that He's created and the level of detail there. So just maybe that helps to explain the level of detail we see in this particular portion and indeed the ones that follow, because it's all about the details. It's not the devil that's in the details in this case. It's the hand of the Creator that's evident there. Now, one other one, kind of along these same lines, and that's, I think, was alluded to this morning in the discussion that you just heard in the recording a bit ago. But certainly, many people have noticed over the millennia that there are two primary narratives of creation in the Scripture. The most obvious one is in Genesis, where Elohim creates the whole universe, Ha'olam. But the other one is right here, beginning in this Torah portion, where the children of Israel create the Mikdash, or the Mishkan, the sanctuary. And the connection, they will suggest, various sages, and I'm not going to argue with them at all, because I think they make some pretty good points here. The connection is not merely incidental, it's unmistakable. The second one that we see kind of mirrors the former one. I got a little table here. This again comes from Rabbi Sachs, explaining here are some of the places where you can see it. And as I go through this, I'll just note that there are some words, keywords in the Hebrew and in the English that will appear over and over again. And they are things like make or see, complete, bless, sanctify, behold, and the work that is being discussed. So I'll go through this fairly quickly as well. We know what it says in the creation of the universe from Genesis narrative, and God made the sky. Corresponding section, Exodus, they shall make me a sanctuary. God made two large lights, they shall make me an ark. God made the beasts of the earth, make a table. There's an ordering here, and there's a similar set of time-based things that happen. And then we get to the point where it says, and Elohim saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Genesis 1:31. When this portion of the creation of the furnishings and the tabernacle and the ark and all the things that go within it and the garments that the priests wore, when all of that is done, it says Moshe saw all the skilled work, and behold, they had done it as God commanded it. They had done it. And then there's a wrap-up, both in Genesis and in Exodus. The heavens and the earth and all of their array were completed. Chapter 2, verse 1. All the work of the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, was completed. And God completed all the work that he had done, next verse, as well as, and Moshe completed the work. And finally, we get to the point where Elohim blessed it, and Moshe blessed it in the corresponding part, and sanctified it. This is from Elohim. And then finally, you shall sanctify it and all its vessels. It's a command from Elohim to Moshe. So again, those key words appear, and it looks like there's a pretty nice parallel there. But of course, and this is something I'll emphasize frequently because I come from an engineering background, as some of you know. When you see things that look similar, when you see parallels, when you see things in Scripture like parables and metaphors and similes, oftentimes the similarity, of course, is very instructive. That's why metaphor is such a powerful rhetorical device. It helps us to see something in a different way and go, I kind of get the idea here. But sometimes, especially in Scripture, you see it in engineering as well. If you really want to understand something, look for two things that are almost identical, and then spend time talking about, thinking about, studying, even mathematically analyzing the differences, because it's the differences that will really point out what's going on. Now, in engineering, what we're talking about is a thing called a servo. Every servo in the world, from an autopilot and an airplane to all the things that are in computers and in mechanical plants, they all work on this principle of saying, okay, here's what I want, here's what I've got. What I have is not exactly equal to what I want. How can I tell? Well, I look at the differences, and then I use the slight differences to help me hone and correct and feed back and make the thing more perfect. Okay. That's great. But sometimes it's the differences that, will hone us. If we look at the things that are similar but not the same, they'll show us what it is that the Creator is pointing out here. That's particularly true, and I've made this point many, many times. If you look and you see what looks like a contradiction in Scripture, he said this before, but now he's saying something different. Uh-uh. It's not him that's wrong. He's making a really subtle point. Look and see the differences in precisely what he's saying, and you'll note that there's a very important lesson in understanding those differences. All right, back to this parallel then, if you will, between these two creation narratives. The creation of the universe, here's an obvious one. The whole thing, Now think about this. This is the creation of the whole universe, for crying out loud, in Genesis, in the first part of chapter 2, in after Genesis 1, takes 34 whole verses. Not much. And yet, of something that, well, we've just finished saying, yeah, there's a lot of detail, but it's temporary. What could this possibly matter? That takes hundreds of verses, and it runs through something like 5 Torah portions, beginning in the one we're talking about now. And when you add it all up, it's something like 10 times as long. Why would something that would seem so, well, almost trivial compared to the universe, take up so much space in the Torah? And I like the way the author of this one puts it, Sachs. The answer is profound. The Torah is not man's book of God; it's God's book of mankind. And if you realize who we're talking about here, man versus God, it's not difficult at all for an infinite, omnipotent Creator to make a home for humanity. But what is difficult for human beings, given that they're finite and vulnerable and not quite as sharp as He is to make a home for Elohim. But that's what's being described. Yeah, it makes sense. It would take more verbiage, and it probably, as we see it, it took a picture. It took them saying, look according to the pattern that I'm showing you on the mountain. Now, let's talk about a couple more words in here, just to finish setting the stage. One of those words, kadosh, holy, set apart, right? You've heard this word. We talk about it all the time. We're talking about building something here that's being set apart, too. Something where the universe, if you think about it, is arguably not even remotely big enough to contain Him, and yet how can He dwell within a tabernacle? Part of the key is to understand that it is set apart. And then there's another couple of words, too. I got a question on the screen. Ah, thank you. I see the book is on the door. The beast that crouches at the door. That's right. The question, I'll admit, I don't understand. What all went into the Apura nickel? Okay, if you can rephrase that, Segal, I'll try to see if I don't understand it. Mishkan and tabernacle were some of the words that were being used, so maybe that's the question. But if you're talking about the tabernacle per se, those are the things that are being described in this portion in some detail, and that's the detail I'm referring to, even though I haven't gone into the detail at this point. Anyway, I was talking about a couple words. The word olam, right? Everything. Universe. Ha olam. The universe, or the everything. Is, according to the sages and those who have a better understanding of Hebrew, very closely related to another word, which is ne'elam, which means hidden. Now, I spent a lot of time talking about this last night. This is one of those things that, because it verges on some other topics that are, uncomfortable is probably a good way to put it, right? What's the word that is often used in English to mean hidden? It's occult. Are we talking about the occult, the secret knowledge, the Gnosticism? No. I'm going to try to be, because just like in so many places where we say, veer not to the right or to the left, right, there's this narrow path, you can go over the top and you can fall into the opposite ditch when you get into the point where you say, I have occult hidden knowledge that you don't have. That makes me better, more powerful, and more willing and able to rule than you, and so forth and so on. Well, we know what lies down that path. Nevertheless, there is an aspect of truth in it. It's the old 80-20 rule once again. Another way to look at it is that those who are walking in rebellion will often try to imitate what the Creator does. It's a fake. It's something put in His place. There's really nothing new in that. So don't let the fact that there are some things, in fact, that are hidden from us, even in Scripture, be a stumbling block, is what I'm trying to get to. So I do like the way that it's put here, and I'll use a couple of other related examples to try and make the case here. You know that in Scripture, we're told that the Creator does nothing, but first He reveals it through His servants, the prophets. I quote that one all the time because it's important, and it's what we're seeing unfold before us now. Certainly that means that there are things that we can see in prophecy that, you know what, sometimes we don't understand them. If you will, they're hidden up until the point where, once they do happen, we look back at them in hindsight and we go, well, for crying out loud, that was pretty obvious, wasn't it? So things can be hidden in plain sight. And I'll suggest to you that's a lot of what we're seeing in the Torah portion, too. If there are meanings in here, if there are parallels we're supposed to draw, sometimes they're not obvious to us except in hindsight, or maybe without diligent study, study to show yourself approved. It is to the glory of God to hide a thing, but the honor of kings to search it out. Those verses certainly apply. All right. Well, back to the narrative here, and the part of this connection between this word olam, or everything, or universe, and ne'alam, meaning hidden. Think of it this way, and I'm gonna hearken first to this analogy of a parent. If a parent is ever present, omnipotent, knows all and sees all. Now, young kids probably think that that's what daddy does. He does. He knows all and he sees all. But as we get a little older, we realize, well, daddy's not always there. Sometimes I can get away with something. Maybe he finds out later, and if we thought we could get away with it and we didn't, it's probably worse, right? But nevertheless, there's an aspect to parenting that is important here, and that is, in order for the parent to allow the child to grow up, sometimes the parent has to let the child make mistakes. Sometimes there has to be some risk taken. Child has to be allowed to fail in order to succeed. And if the child is always and completely and utterly under supervision at all times, maybe they never mature at all. And the same thing seems to apply to our Creator, and we see that in these stories beginning to work out. I like the way it's phrased here. For there to be the possibility of a being like us, like mankind, to have free will, to have choice, and we know that that's the essence of Torah, right? Choose this day whom you will serve. I have laid before you life and blessing, death and cursing. Therefore, choose life. Got commandments. You can walk in obedience to them, or you can walk in rebellion. So for us to have this possibility of free will or choice or moral responsibility, Elohim, the Creator, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, cannot be always and utterly in our face, tangible. Because if he's always there, and we know, now some of us know this anyway, right? But there's a lot of people that don't. They'll deny he even exists at all. What, he's watching me? Ha ha ha. Well, let him take care of this or that. He does allow himself to be in such a place that we can deny him or we can acknowledge him. We can walk in obedience or in rebellion. That's part of what he's given to us. So, here's the bottom line. If you think about it in this respect, the infinite crowds out the finite. Yes, God is like a parent, but he, like a parent, eventually has to let us go, or we'll never learn to walk, or stumble, or do the right things, or to grow up. So now we have this paradox. If he is perceptible everywhere, then there's no room for mankind to make mistakes. But if he's not perceptible anywhere, then how can we come to know him? Well, perhaps now the answer to the paradox gets more and more clear. If we can't understand him in completeness, we can at least begin to get an understanding about aspects of him. He has told us via his word what he wants from us. Not necessarily everything. He still allows us free will, the choice. But we have some instructions, some concepts. So, the way I would like to think about it is this way. He reserves places where he is more set apart. Things is a tough word. Well, here's how the rabbi that I'm looking at puts it. He says, God reserves in a number of dimensions a domain that is peculiarly his. One of those dimensions is time. It's easy to see, all right? He reserves and says, set apart for us too. Remember, his Sabbath, one day in seven. And there are multiple cycles, too. Seventh month, seventh year, eventually the Jubilee, seven times seven plus one. The second place that you'll see this set apartness is among the nations. After the unfortunate incident at the Tower of Babel and the division of languages and civilizations, he set apart a covenant people for himself, those that are B'nai, the sons of Israel. And finally, we get this third aspect of where he can be set apart, too. That's in space. That's what we're talking about this week, the tabernacle. And each of them, set apart, kadosh, holy, is a point at which, say the sages, this divine presence can be less hidden. Emerge from a place where it is hidden to a place where, if we will seek him out and go to his place, he will reveal himself to us. It's what the Sabbath is about. It was the point of building a tabernacle so that he could dwell among them, so that they could go there. and experience that presence. So, as the tabernacle was to time, or is to time, says this the story. Let me say it again. Mess that up. As the Shabbat, as the Sabbath, is in time, so the tabernacle is in space. It's set apart. I'm going to pause. There's another point that I could go to here. We'll come back to this one a little bit later on. I'll set that aside. And let's talk about one other aspect of this whole tabernacle thing as we kind of lay out the pieces for today. We said this is just a temporary place. This tabernacle is being built. Later there'll be a temple that's built. It too, as it turns out, while it lasted longer, or may have, ultimately it was temporary. So, let's return to a couple of questions that I asked up front. We've kind of given a couple answers for why there's so much detail in this portion. And there are some parallels between this creation and the first creation. There are some aspects to set-apartness, to holiness, that are appropriate to this story. And then you kind of ask the question of, well, we know there's a lot of detail here. Why? Okay, we've seen an answer to that. But why here? Why is it that the Creator of the universe chooses to put that particular part of the narrative, build me a tabernacle, a mishkan, why does it appear in Exodus? And I think there's a fairly straightforward answer. The history of the Israelites up till now, think about it. Now, you'll hear me put it this way. Other sages will perhaps put a little bit more. I'm not saying I'm a sage, by the way. Just other people who have studied this will put it a little differently. You'll hear me joke about the whining. Oh, no! Oh, the leeks were so much better! We had all this much better food! Why have you brought us out in the wilderness to die over and over again? We see this pattern. Now, am I picking on any group in particular? No. It's the human condition, folks. We laugh because we recognize it's in all of us. But when you look at the history, it seems fairly clear. First, we have this long series of complaining. Again, my word, whining. They whined when Moses first intervened and made the situation worse, right? He appears to them. He's going to do some good stuff for them. What does Pharaoh do? He's going to take away your straw. Oh, no, it was bad before. Now it's so much worse. Why don't you just leave us alone? Then they go out, and at the Red Sea, we hear the whine. Oh, was it because there were no graves in Egypt, Mitzrayim, that you brought us out here in a desert to die? What have you done? Leave us alone. Let's go back. We want to go back into bondage. We want to go back. We want to go back. After the sea, we got the first time there's lack of water. They complained. Then the water is bitter at Marah. They complained. Then there was lack of food. And they complain. And then there's more lack of water again. And they complain. And finally, they did more than complain. They said, well, we're going to make ourselves a golden calf after Sinai. So I like the question that can be asked when you look at this and think, okay, here's the way human nature works. If all the miracles that they've seen, from the plagues upon Mitzrayim, to the parting of the Red Sea, to the destruction of their oppressors, to the provision for things that they needed in the wilderness when they needed them, if that can't bring about what you'd have to call a mature response on the part of a nation of people, then what will, for crying out loud? By the way, I see a comment on the screen. There's going to be a lot of whining soon, and of course that's always at the heart of where I'm headed, so thanks for tipping people off on that score. But maybe you already knew that. But this is a key point. They've seen, you know, yeah, people whine, and there's going to be a lot of whining soon. So maybe it's a good time to say, as then, now again. If people cannot behave maturely, given all that they've seen, what the heck is it going to take? And this portion provides us at least another part of that answer. Again, it's in the details. Elohim seems to say to them, let them build something together. And I think this is really profound. Speak to the children of Israel that they take for me to Rumah, an offering, heave offering, of every man, that of course includes the other sex as well, of all those folks whose heart makes them willing, you shall take my offering. And again, it's physical, And it's spiritual, if you will. It's in their skills and in their willingness to pitch in and help. So here's what I'm going to call the kind of the key point that connects the then and the now in this story today. They contributed. We've already seen that. Some gold, some silver, some skins, drapes, others gave their time and their skill. So much so that eventually we're told, Moshe told them, enough already, stop. And it was this building together that transformed them. Sachs puts it. It's not what Elohim or God does for us that transforms us. It is what we do for Him. Sounds a little bit like John Kennedy might have grabbed something from that. But the concept is ancient, folks. You really want, you've heard it taught in another way. And I'll tell you that on Shabbat, it's a great blessing to be here in the Midrash. Iron sharpens iron. You want to learn something? Teach it. I would encourage everybody, teach Torah to your friends, to your children, to your neighbors. You'll learn it. It's not what He does for us that transforms us, it's what we do for Him. One aspect of that is teaching. Another is building. Another is getting together as a community and learning what kind of things we can do. Now, here's another way of stating this. And again, this too applies today. Every crisis that happened, so long as it was dealt with by Elohim, and I'm going to choose that term here deliberately, the mighty ones, in this case Moshe and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, whether it was miracles or whether it was answering questions, the Israelites remained in a state of dependency, and their default response was whining.
No, it's not enough. It's not enough. You just didn't give us enough yet. We want more.
For them to grow up, there has to be some kind of a transition from being passive recipients of continual blessings and even miracles. The miracles show who He is. Those are a witness to future generations of His authority, His mighty hand. And yeah, they should have seen something there. They did. But it wasn't enough to get them to grow up. What was needed for them to grow up in the modern sense, they had to become creators as well. Now, again, narrow path. Veer not to the right or to the left. You can get uppity. Look what I have done by my mighty hand. And Scripture very, very clearly outlines that distinction. They did it according to His pattern, in accord with His command. It was built the way He told them to build it. He is always in control and essentially the parent in this situation. But He is letting His children build something and learn in the process. They had to become Elohim's partners in the work of creation. That's essentially this other difference that binds these two narratives together, the one in Genesis and this one, the creation of the Mishkan. What's the big difference? In the first one, God did it all Himself. In the second one, He is using these willing partners who are going to make Him an offering. And in the process of doing for Him, what they're really doing is for themselves. And for Him. So I like this. I'm gonna let Him state it the way He does. And I'll take a little bit broader view. He says the Jewish view of the human condition is that everything we achieve is due to our own efforts, but equally and essentially, it is also the result of God's blessing. We don't do anything without Him. You know, it's we may work, but it's He that builds the house. And it's key, and I emphasize this over and over again. Essentially, the Hebraic understanding is do something. Don't tell me how much you believe. Show me your faith by your works. Get up and do it. Build. And that brings me back, by the way, to the connection, the difference, the compare and contrast, the old versus the new. We're seeing a time here in the Torah when the people got up and they built. Oh, by the way, what else do we see, coincidentally, not happening during this whole section of time when they're building the Mishkan? No whining! Isn't that an amazing thing? This was the first great project they undertook to build together. It literally brought to closure their birth as a nation, and it helped to move them along this path of maturation as a society. So that's, again, where I come back to the present day and say, look at what we see happening today. I mean, for crying out loud, I'm not even going to talk about it, but I've got a stack of articles here. I'll at least begin to mention one or two of them. The State of the Union message was this week. What union, folks? It's a state of disunion, and I refer to it as the police state of the union. For the most part, the speech as it was is not worth talking about. But what is interesting is the dramatic contrast. The creator of the universe is saying, look, I'm going to help you here. I'm going to show you the pattern, but I want you to build. It's evidently not enough for me to keep doing miracle after miracle after miracle, because all I get is whining and complaining. It's not moving you along the path towards maturing as a society. Well, guess what? What did we see this week? I love the whining and the complaining. We got whining and complaining every time something goes wrong. Oh, Washington's got to fix it. We can't. People can't do these things for themselves. Who will create jobs? Who will give us food? Well, only the Elohim from Washington, of course. That's the only answer. In other words, they're being moved right smack back into dependence. You can do nothing without Washington. Don't even try. You need to be safe? Well, look at the Super Bowl coming up this weekend. Gonna build you the most awe-inspiring police state that you could imagine. You thought the parting of the Red Sea was a big deal? No! Check out what we're gonna do to you at the gates at the stadium in New Jersey. Gonna grope you, gonna expose your nakedness, and gonna show you who the man really is. You wanna build something? No, don't come here. What we're seeing, in other words, is destruction. Destruction on a massive scale. Destruction of an economy. Destruction of a system that has already pretty well been rotted out from within because it's turned long, long ago from Torah. You've heard me talk many times about the dishonest weights and measures that he calls an abomination. It will not last. It's being destroyed. We'll talk more about some of those aspects because I want to make this point a number of different ways today. But I want you to look at the contrast between a nation that is coming together because it's going to learn to build something for Elohim, as opposed to another nation that is now in disunity because it is learning that the only Elohim that matters is a whole different God to begin with. And if he doesn't do it for you, it won't get done. You can't possibly do it for yourselves. You little children, you can't be trusted to provide for your own food, for your own education. You sure as heck can't prevent attacks from outside. Only we can prevent terrorism. And only the almighty police state can keep you safe. I mean, time after time, it's exactly, again, the opposite. It's upside down. It's everything backwards. And what's the ultimate intent? It's to move people back away from being a mature society into being independent. No, to being dependent little slaves serving another god or another set of Elohim. In this case, I do think, although I'll draw some distinctions too, people will talk about democracy and so forth, and as you know, I refer to it as demonocracy, and we'll point out that if you look through Torah, you won't find any place in Torah where the will of a majority as opposed to the will of God is ever the right answer. If you got questions, we'll answer that, but, there's at least three major places where you see a vote or something that looks suspiciously like it being taken. Not one of them ever works out right. So having said that, I'll quote a couple of other lines here from this same piece about leadership and building together. There's a fundamental distinction, says this author, between the state and society when it comes to politics. The state, and I don't disagree with this at all, represents what is done for us, or against us maybe, by the machinery of government through the instrumentality of laws and courts and taxation, public spending. But society is, in contrast, what we do for one another through things like community, voluntary association, charities, and various other kinds of do-gooder organizations. And this rabbi, of course, says that Judaism has a marked preference for society rather than the state. Now, that's not necessarily true of some aspects, because, as you probably are aware, there's a 501c3 state-chartered, Caesar-created, faith-based version of Judaism, just like there is of ex-Chianity. And guess what? They all serve the same master, that state. So the central theme of the book of Exodus, he says, is this same concept. What we do for others is what matters. It's not what others or even what God does for us that transforms us. Now, there's another line in here I want to put onto the table just because I think it's a good one. Most of you are familiar with de Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, who visited America in the early part of the 1800s. And talked about its strengths and what it had going for it. The book was called Democracy in America. And he, in this passage that I'm going to read a pretty good chunk of, says that democracies are at risk of a completely new form of oppression, which is true. We've now seen it come to fruition, for which there was no precedent before. Well, unless you count places like Athens, where people exist solely in and for themselves. And it becomes literally a mobocracy. That's why I refer to it as demonocracy. So here's the quote from de Tocqueville. Above this race of men stands an immense and tutelatory power, which takes upon itself alone to secure their gratifications and to watch over their fate. That power is absolute, minute, regular, provident, and mild. It would be like the authority of a parent if, like that authority, its object was to prepare men for manhood. But instead, on the contrary, it seeks to keep them in perpetual childhood. It's exactly what we're seeing today. It is well content that the people should rejoice, provided that they think of nothing but rejoicing. For their happiness, such a government willingly labors. But it chooses to be the sole agent and the only arbiter of that happiness. In other words, folks, de Tocqueville's not going to say it, and the rabbi doesn't point it out, but I will. It seeks to be their God. Hey, who can provide happiness? Only this new Elohim. It provides for their security, foresees for their supplies and necessities, facilitates their pleasures. Hey, it handles Hollywood, doesn't it? Manages their principal concerns, directs their industry, regulates the descent of their property, and subdivides their inheritance. What remains for it then but to spare them all the care of thinking and all the trouble of living? It is. It's a pretty nasty and very prescient observation. Now, here's where I part company with Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, because he says that while this is visible in European societies, Tocqueville was not a religious writer. Now, that's true on the surface. Tocqueville makes no references to the Hebrew Bible. But what he does do, folks, is lay out a pretty good warning here. And I will suggest to you that when you ask the question, is Tocqueville writing with a certain aspect of fervor? You could call it a religious fervor if you want. Everybody remembers probably the most famous quote from Democracy in America by de Tocqueville. The line is, America is great because America is good. And when America ceases to be good, it will cease to be great. How do we define good? Answer. He said, it's seen in the American pulpits. It was a time when, and this was before the 501c3 epidemic, it was a time when people, to the best that they had with the understanding of a hidden aspect that's still being revealed to us, line by line, precept by precept today, they were still talking about doing what is right. And how did they know what was right? Well, it was in the pages of Scripture. So let me summarize a couple of things on that score, and then we'll talk again about the dramatic contrast, this difference engine, this difference between what we can see in Scripture and what we can see going on now, and what it is that it tells us we ought to be doing. And I'm going to hearken back again to this disconnect, this change between the creation narrative in Genesis and the one that we see in this parsha beginning in Exodus. Genesis 31 concludes, I read this a while ago, Elohim saw all that he had made. Behold, it was tov meod. It was very good. Simple statement. He behold all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And then when we get to the end of the corresponding similar portion here, this time, Moshe saw all the skilled work. Behold, they had done it as Elohim had commanded it. And there you see the similarity and the difference in one nice succinct place. We can look at the distinction, and it's as plain as the nose on your face. They had done the work, and it was good because they had done it as Elohim had commanded it. And in the process, like we said, there were a whole bunch of other blessings and benefits for them. So when we step back and look and see where we're at right now, we got so much detail here. So much that has essentially been hidden. Yeah, I'm doing some spiritualization. Yeah, there are some parallels. Yeah, we have to connect some dots to see this stuff. Hey, that's the nature of studying for ourselves and looking at Scripture. So much has been hidden from us, and yet, here it is, hidden in the detail in plain sight. It's, again, it's like these six fundamental constants of the universe. They're there. They're hidden. We don't necessarily see them, but we can measure them. Science over the years has put together and calculated what these constants are and what they have to be in order for the universe to go tick, tick, tick and work the way that it's supposed to. And if then we will look a little deeper, we will see, whew, the more we learn about His creation, the more we realize it had to be His creation. Because if the details aren't precisely accurate, if these constants aren't exactly what they had to be, we don't exist. So we get a more understanding from the depth of the details. Again, that's why I would encourage people, go back and reread this stuff for yourself. Look at it. I talked about it a little bit more last night and still kind of waved my hands and said, hey, I ain't smart enough to figure it out. But when you look at the dimensions that are given in here, and, you know, they'll make for me an ark of acacia wood. 2 cubits and a half shall be the length, 1 cubit and a half the breadth, and 1 cubit and a half the height. Overlay it with pure gold. Some have suggested this is a big capacitor, a Leyden jar. Well, are the inner and outer parts connected? We don't have enough detail. I think so. So it's not quite the same. But the point is, there's all kinds of mathematics in here. He gives a whole bunch of detail about the size of the exterior and the border around the tabernacle. And the numbers of cups on the candlestick and of pieces and aspects and the sockets and all that. I have no doubt that if we were smart enough and had enough time to study and could go through all these numbers, we would see fascinating things in the differences and in the ratios and in the patterns that are being laid out for us. But I'm not going to claim to understand it yet. It's hidden. It's in plain sight. And eventually it'll be revealed to us. For now, however, there are other things that we can and should focus on. I'm going to go back again to this idea of the cusp or the tipping point and suggest that just as this portion begins by saying, take for me an offering of every man whose heart makes him willing, you shall take my offering. What? All kinds of things. Physical things, spiritual things, skill kind of things, intellectual kinds of things. You got a skill, you got an ability, bring it. We can use it. By the way, he'll add to it. According to all that I show you, the pattern of the tabernacle, the pattern of all the furnishings therein, you shall make it. Do this for me. And I do like and believe. It's do this for me in every generation. This command applies to us today. If we are willing. And by the way, it's time. That's the key thing. That's what I'm going to spend most of the rest of today talking about, is the fact that we need to be willing. We need to make sure we understand that we're building something for Him so that He may dwell among us. Is it going to be in exactly the same fashion? No. Yeah, there's a lot of metaphor here. There's a lot of spiritualization going on here. But I can assure people firsthand, you know, just based on my own limited witness as one person, that if we will do these things, He will do the things He says He will do. Does He dwell among us in the way that we want Him to? Not always. Does He make His presence known in the way that we would demand He would make it known? Not always. But there are nevertheless blessings for obedience, period. That part is absolutely sure. I will suggest to folks, you can bet your lives on it. You can bet more than that on it. He is who He says He is. In contrast to those other fake gods who are lying through their teeth. So I've already said I'm not going to waste any more time on the State of the Union. What did we see? The man who would be king. Literally, an emperor that says, I'm not going to let the Congress stand in my way. I'm not going to let the written law stand in my way either. I got a pen and I'm going to use it. I'm going to bring you all kinds of blessings and miracles, things that can only be done by Washington, so that you can be more dependent than you already are, so that we can continue to deconstruct the things that were based on that other Elohim, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, who's not welcome in our schools. Takes a village now, not a god of the Bible. And so forth and so on. It's time. It's a cusp. It's a time we need to be aware of and making an offering and making sure that we're not making our offerings to the wrong gods, but to the right ones. By the way, I'm going to come back to this theme, too. I've already mentioned it once, and I actually hammered on it a bit last week, too. Coming up real soon, Super Bowl Sunday. And I'm going to again suggest that if you really want to see an offering made to another god in a tabernacle made with hands, but not according to the pattern of the one that we're told to, check it out. Or maybe don't. But do what you do knowingly. Look at the differences between what the Scripture tells us and what we're going to see being told to us at places like that. I see the command on this, the comment on the screen from Snake Stopper. I'm going to pass by law and rule over you, and the serfs applaud. And it reminds me of that line from one of the Star Trek movies where Princess Amidala says, "This is how liberty dies," to thunderous applause. And it really is true. Star Wars. Oh, did I say Star Trek? Sorry. Yes, Star Wars. All right. Any comments, questions on anything so far? Did I miss anything that scrolled by? We got several eyes watching if they did. And by the way, I cannot stay in the other room. It keeps kicking me off. So if there were comments over there, somebody can put them across in the Pal Talk one where we can see them. Questions, whatever. The QQQs are always good. That'll help. So put the QQQs in front, especially if I didn't answer it yet. I'm going to start with this one because, as you know, Jeff and I do the Drive Time Friday show on Friday mornings, and I got a stack of news this week and stuff that all bears on where we are as a society and what's going on in respect to, you know, prophetic fulfillments of things we can be looking forward to. That it's mind-boggling. It's probably the biggest stack I've had in a long time, and it's all stuff that people would say this is really very important. By the way, it all points in the same direction. But this one actually came out after we finished the Friday show. And it's probably just as well because we had more news than we could talk about as it was. But the version I saw came from the Daily Mail online. It was a reference to a story that is coming out from, starts with a P, Politico. And they're doing a great big story. I saw several other summaries of it afterwards. I've got a nice one here from Paul Joseph Watson. It was up on Prison Planet. Just a brief summary of the political story. And it turns out that all of these things are summaries of a book that this former TSA agent, a guy named Jason Harrington, has written. And there's more meat in here than there's more meat in here that we can get our heads around. But I'm going to start it because when I look back at the week, I think, here you go. You want a single summary of something that just kind of helps put in perspective. This is it. I like the Mail's headline. They say, they're quoting from his book. This is a TSA guy, ex-TSA guy, who they say confirms your very worst fears. Well, not really, because I'm going to extrapolate where this is headed, right? It's to the biggest brother you can imagine. So the very worst fear is, look at the Nazis, look at Stalin, you name it. Whether you're talking stormtroopers, jackbooted thugs, or blue-gloved criminals who operate in violation of what was once called the supreme law of the land. Same thing. It's what happens when men serve another god. And it inevitably goes to the very same place. What this guy is telling you is, yeah, we knew it. You know it. Question is whether the powers that be will ever admit it. Okay, so he said the following. Here's their headline. We laugh at naked bodies and take apple butter from old ladies. They enjoyed laughing at passengers' looks as they scanned them in the naked body scanners. They had all kinds of little code words that they used. There's a whole bunch of them listed in here. Hotel Papa was one. That was from the from another summary. They would say, "Ooh," to the guy in the little booth. "Hotel Papa coming." That means hot, you know what. You're going to get a real nice chance to look at some you know what nakedness here. They do see you naked, in spite of the lies, is the beginning of the piece. Harrington says, I confiscated jars of homemade apple butter on the pretense that they could pose threats to national security. And people were stupid enough to believe it. Or either that or they were so cowed that they were afraid to say, come on, we all know you're a liar. I was even required, he said, to confiscate nail clippers from pilots, airline pilots. The implied logic being that pilots could use those nail clippers to hijack the very airplanes they were flying. As if they couldn't do worse damage on a whim. Okay. He said one of the most coveted rotations while he worked at O'Hare Airport in Chicago was the secretive image operator room, where the guards took turns sitting in that windowless room, which, oh, and they knew this very well, also lacked security cameras. So they could do whatever they wanted in there. And they did. They would take little nookie breaks, I guess you'd call it. And once they got all worked up looking at the naked pictures, they could do whatever they wanted in there. I mean, we're talking stuff that they all knew was going on. And this is paid for by the stupid taxpayers who were getting groped and x-rayed and ogled for the pleasure of these folks. All the old crass stereotypes, and I'm quoting here, he says, about race and genitalia size thrived on our secure government radio channels. They even had TSA briefings where the fat cats, people who would represent the naked body scanner machine manufacturers, would come to give the agents tutorials on the $150,000 machines. And those people admitted, get this, that they barely worked. Quote, he, the TSA sales machine from the vendor, he said we wouldn't be able to distinguish plastic explosives from body fat, and that guns were practically invisible if they were turned sideways in a pocket. Later on, another story says, yep, the agency downplayed all of that, and the TSA instructed us to begin patting down the sides of every fifth passenger as a clumsy workaround. I mean, this kind of stuff is incredible. They realized, in other words, that what they were doing was worthless. But hey, it's a job. We're building an empire here. The author Harrington said he hinted several times on his blog, and he evidently wrote letters to supervisors, too, up until he realized the only thing that would accomplish was getting him fired, that a determined terrorist's best bet for defeating airport security would be to apply for a job with TSA, simply become part of the security system itself, because it was so holy, and he doesn't mean set apart, that it would make it easy to do what they wanted to do. That assertion, he says, stemmed from personal experience. And he said, furthermore, most of his co-workers hated the agency that they worked for, too. Most TSA officers I talked to told me they felt the agency's day-to-day operations represented an abuse of public trust and funds. And that's putting it mildly, folks, because, of course, what we know is some of them may have bothered to pull out the Constitution and realize everything they were doing was a blatant slap in the face to the very rule of law they thought they were supporting. I got one more comment here. Or was the question having to do with where's the link? The guy's name is Jason Harrington. Harrington. Jason Harrington. His book. I'll have to let you find the book. The article was in Politico. This one's on the Mail Online, and we'll find it here in a minute. Again, you know, we could go into all kinds of details. The book has just literally tons of stuff. But the point is, there's nothing new here. This is security theater, and we've known this for a long, long time. And what we're beginning to see, this is something I've talked about many, many times, is this split, right? It's about the differences, the difference between what people are told and what they recognize the truth is. I saw story after story this week. People watched the State of the Disunion or the Police State of the Union message. And they realize that the old joke, sad and disgusting as it is true. When these people are lying to you, you know it because their lips are moving. And it was that blatant. So what we saw this week was the Nobel Peace Prize winner talking about, hey, he's not going to be governed by the rule of law. And then funny, I'm just going to throw this one out here, the Nobel Committee in Norway has nominated Edward Snowden to receive the Nobel Peace Prize this year. Now, I'll admit, Snowden has certainly done a lot more for world peace than the last high-profile winner, who, is one of the biggest warmongers in the world. Snowden's actions, said Reuters, reporting from the Nobel Committee, have led to the reintroduction of trust and transparency. Come on. No, it has exposed the lie. Certainly hasn't led to the reintroduction of trust. anyway, is a leading principle in global security policies. At least Snowden has pointed it out. And what I'm pointing out and what others have pointed out is the Nobel Committee does not generally, unless they choose to, release the names of the nominees. Remember, we're not talking about the winner. We're talking about the nominee. A lot of times they don't ever get released until 50 years later. You know, who were the ones that were also RANs. But in this case, they chose to point out that they have nominated Snowden. And I will suggest to you that the reason is simple. They're trying to save face. Because people are waking up to the lies and they're getting disgusted and they're saying, for crying out loud, look at the cretins, liars, and emperors, and Stalins and Hitlers that are being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And, we're going to at least nominate a whistleblower here, so maybe we can restore a little bit of the prestige to this much maligned so-called prize. Going to talk about economics. Because, again, Two quotes that you'll recognize, follow the money is one. You want to know where the corruption is, follow the money. And the other one, the love of money is the root of all evil. Some of you know where that one comes from, too. And, of course, what we understand is that the stuff that's being passed, currency is a better term, it's not real money anyway. It's certainly not KSEF, and it's not constitutional. And there's no money in the world right now that is redeemable for anything real or even represents a unit of honest weight or measure. So we're seeing all kinds of things coming down. As a matter of fact, like I said, I'm going to go through several of these in some more detail, but I want to try to lay out the case here of this idea of a cusp or a tipping point. We are very, very close to when a whole bunch of stuff is literally predetermined to be set to explode. What do I mean by that? Well, a couple cases in point. Check the date. Today is February the 1st. It's a Shabbat. Markets are closed. Tomorrow, Sunday, markets are closed. What's happening Sunday? Oh, yeah! The most important sporting event in the United States. Great big possible false flag. Opportunity, I guess you'd have to say, if nothing else. It's certainly something to be concerned about. If there was any news between Friday and Monday, you're not going to hear about it. If there are options expirations, and there are, at the end of the month, there are options expiring. There are contracts expiring on things like paper gold and paper silver and stocks and other stuff. There's a whole lot of other stuff coming due in the Federal Reserve's toxic waste that they call their bond portfolio. Mortgage bonds that were five-year bonds. Guess what? Look back in time. 5 years ago, 2013, end of 2013 to end of 2008. These were a lot of toxic bonds that were purchased that have five-year expirations, and billions of dollars worth of them are coming due real soon now. In other words, somebody needs a whole lot of money to keep the sham going for a little while longer. And I see on the screen, yeah, the debt ceiling and other alleged stuff. Not that the debt ceiling matters, other than it's a political football that can be kicked around. Hey, there's a great metaphor for today. So you see a number of things beginning to come together, and essentially I'm going to point out several more that say, whoo, it's a real big time for a possible worldwide economic breakdown. But before we do that, I want to throw out one more that isn't going to get much attention. I did talk about this during the week. I mentioned it last night as well. So I know some folks have heard it already, but bear with me. We'll talk about it again. In the last week or so, we saw natural gas futures and spot prices soar. Natural gas was up almost 10%, over $5 a gallon in a lot of the United States, up 20% on the week a while ago. The story that from Zero Hedge here says, from a glut to a whiff of a panic, natural gas soars. So, what's the big deal? Another story. This one has been talked about a lot of times, but from the Western Journalism Center comes word that the Obama administration's attack on the coal industry in America has now swung into high gear. The EPA enforcers are setting new emission rates for coal-fired electric power plants that are so low that virtually no plant in the United States will be able to meet the new standards. Now, by the way, they quote Obama himself, 2008. He threatened to bankrupt America's coal industry by forcing energy prices to go sky high. Well, the new EPA rules would double well, they would more than double. They would increase prices dramatically and ultimately slash power output nationwide by 40%. Because there's a lot of power plants in the United States that are based on coal. They're fixing to shut them down. Hasn't been a new coal plant built in a long time. Now, we got electric plants that are based on nuclear energy, and we're seeing how some of that looks as a result of what's happening in Japan. By the way, a lot of the same reactors made by GE, close to 100 of them, are still operating in the United States, and the stories that I've seen say 90% of those are leaking. So let me ask you a question. Are you more concerned about the already clean coal that's being burned, or are you already more concerned about the nuclear plants that represent the biggest natural or man-made, non-natural disaster in human history, already impacting the west coast of the United States and being spread by winds all over the planet? And why is the EPA so stinking concerned about a teeny, teeny bit of additional coal emissions as opposed to people getting nuked and irradiated nationwide? This is idiotic, folks. It's almost as stupid as thinking that a couple of blue-gloved guys in airports groping some little old lady or checking out an old guy's colostomy bag are going to keep you safe from terrorists. Emission rates are so low that coal-fired plants cannot actually meet these new goals, say a number of the industry analysts. Obama EPA enforcers are looking to force coal companies to adopt a very expensive technology called carbon capture and sequestration. Hey, guess what? There's a $1 trillion worldwide carbon footprint trading industry at stake. Doesn't do anything, of course. It's just another bureaucracy, and people like Al Gore are already billionaires as a result of what they've put in place so far. Americans should expect to see their power bills double, and that's the least of it. I'm going to read this paragraph, and then I'm going to point out to you the thing that this article doesn't mention. It says this. Again, the industry has is under attack. The administration's attack via the EPA has swung into high gear. Virtually no plants will be able to make it. More American workers will be thrown out into the cold, their families thrown into the welfare maw, and American dependence on overseas energy sources will be increased. You know what? All of that's important stuff, but it's not the real issue, like I just said. Here's one that comes a lot closer. This comes from the 5-Minute Forecast just this last week. It says, last week, and you already knew this, the price of natural gas took a major step upward. Their analyst, Byron King, says the price of energy, when you look at the equivalent, in other words, how many BTUs are in a gallon of natural gas as opposed to how many BTUs are in a gallon of oil, you do the math, and you find out that it hit the equivalent of $700 per barrel. $700 per barrel is what the equivalent price of natural gas spiked up to. Why? How? Well, the story begins a week ago Tuesday, it says. Another polar vortex. By the way, there's another one on their way. It swept its way south. And while Americans pulled energy from every nook and cranny of different power grids, all connected together in the big grid, the Maryland Calvert Cliffs nuclear power plant got shut down. The problem, at least this is the story from the official spokesperson, was non-nuclear. Not to worry, didn't melt down. Was just a snow and ice formation over a ventilation louver. And the loss of cooling air then tripped a circuit breaker, so Calvert Cliffs went offline. Well, hey, no big deal. Nobody noticed anything. Why? Because the power grid stepped up to make up the difference. The good news is that when Calvert Cliffs went down, other conventional fuel-powered stations in the region, they fired up and they replaced the lost nuclear power. Ah, here's the bad news. The other power plants burn natural gas. Now, I'll suggest to you there's other good news, too. Those plants were there. Yeah, there were natural gas plants available, unlike the coal plants that are being forced out of business. Do you see the connection here? Well, it's going to get more dramatic in just a second. Unanticipated demand as a result of all this switch to plants needing now to burn a lot more natural gas than they had been, forced in the midst of a brutally cold winter heating season, the prices of large volumes of natural gas to make up for the lost electric power to spike. This is called the spot price, and it went up, as they've already said, to over $700 per barrel. So utility companies were faced with a choice. Hey, isn't choice wonderful? They can pay $120 per MCF, that's the rate, or they can shut down. They don't have the gas with which to generate electricity. So he says, this is Byron King, the analyst, when you need it now, sometimes you have to pay a higher price for the urgency. Now, this is one of those things, by the way, that command economists will forget. We'll always hear about hoarding. Well, how dare people hoard things? And ask the folks in New Jersey and in New York when the hurricane struck last time, were they willing to pay more for fuel in order to have warmth, even if it meant somebody was going to profiteer? Or would they rather just do without? Oh, no, we'd rather have government provided for us and force people to do it. That's better. Well, then you won't have it at all. That's the sad truth that's not going to be told. It's not a miracle. God didn't produce it out of nothing. This is somebody that stole it from somebody else. And the idea is, when the market is able to provide it, it will. But it'll come at a price. And sometimes the price is more expensive. And when you shut down the alternatives, when you shut down the coal plants, and when you make the price of natural gas more expensive as a result, and when you see that electric plants that are based on nuclear energy are already in some cases leaking and probably a lot more in need of shutting down than any clean coal plants, we got a whole bunch of dislocations and malinvestments, and another way to put it is chickens coming home to roost. And it will happen. And so what essentially all of the analysts of the power grid are saying is, look, if the sun doesn't get it, and the Chinese EMP or Russian EMP or North Korean EMP doesn't get it, or if a false flag from Washington, like we've seen, doesn't get it, it'll be just plain old economics and the EPA that results in the power grid going down. If it doesn't go down completely, you can expect brownouts and your prices to go dramatically through the roof. What's the message? Be prepared. Be ready. Understand. Know the times and the seasons, and know that when it comes to dependence on the power grid, if you're still dependent on the power grid, if the power grid goes down and you need an iron lung machine or a sleep apnea machine or you need heat, you might like to stay warm in your house. Does your fan require power? I don't care if you got natural gas or not. If you don't have a way to power the fan, the natural gas is not going to come on and heat the house. Your pipes are going to freeze. You may freeze. There's a chain reaction, a set of dominoes that begins to fall. And the dominoes are being, I'm going to suggest, deliberately set up to fall. It's this deconstruction thing. It's about making people ever more dependent on the false god. They expect a miracle, but it's not coming from the Creator. It's coming from the one in Washington. Save me, save me. Whine, whine, whine. I got cold. I got cold because I was relying on the wrong god. So, that brings me to this piece. From former Assistant Treasury Secretary, a guy that I fairly often quote anymore because he's becoming more and more blunt about what's going on, it's Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, who said in an interview that came out yesterday that the United States government, and this is a former insider, mind you, Assistant Treasury Secretary, the U.S. government, he said, is purposefully creating financial chaos all over the world in order to destabilize countries and create a flight into the U.S. dollar. Now, the other thing I didn't mention, I'm going to talk about it in a minute here, is the emerging market crisis. And that was a big deal in the financial markets this week. So we'll come back to that in a second. He said there's different ways you can look at this emerging market mess. One, all the liquidity that the Fed created, well, some of it flowed into the emerging markets. By the way, we're talking about things like Brazil and Turkey, a lot of the smaller countries that are in many cases right now in the midst of some major turmoil. Well, now that the Fed is indicating that they're going to end their quantitative easing, at least they're claiming that they're fixing to taper. That's one of the other stories this week, and I'll probably just leave it at that. Fed tapered another $10 billion on Wednesday, says the statement, ignoring the emerging market crisis. Okay, so not that the taper is anything but what I refer to as a vapor taper. Don't worry, it won't last. But nevertheless, it will have the desired effect in the short term, and that's what Paul Craig Roberts is saying here. Fed is indicating an end to the QE. As it does, it causes the sale of currencies in these emerging markets, and they plummet. That, in turn, causes all kinds of financial chaos. He believes, folks, that this is being done on purpose. That's one way to look at it. And he goes on to say that the government is in a place now where it literally influences or manipulates every market you can think of financially. I've already mentioned the manipulation of markets with things like the EPA, destroying the coal power industry and raising prices in natural gas and electricity. That's more indirect. But directly, however, you have the manipulation of the LIBOR rates, They were calling it a scandal, but it's openly done. The Fed does the same thing when they manipulate interest rates. You've got the London gold fix every morning, the COMEX, I call it the crooked casino, market fixing. You have the plunge protection team. Oh, no, that doesn't exist. That's a conspiracy theory. Well, read the government documents. It's called the Working Group on Financial Markets. And it includes a number of people that are named in the executive order, Secretary of Treasury and the various other high-level financial officers in the government, Fed chairman and so forth. And finally, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is all about manipulating currencies. Okay. Oh, about the wood stoves. Okay, we'll come back to the wood stoves, too. I'll do that real briefly, and I don't know how much I can elaborate. We've got people here that know more about wood stoves than I do, but essentially the EPA is doing the same thing with wood stoves. They put new regs in place and say the old wood stoves that were good enough a year ago, they're no longer good enough today. And so what are we going to do? Well, we're going to make sure that if you want to buy a used wood stove, there's not one available, because we're going to take the old wood stoves, we're going to make the rebates, we're going to mandate some rebates so that people that have the money to buy the new wood stoves but want to trade in an old one will trade it in. Are we going to allow that to be sold on the market? Heck no! We're going to scrap it and smash them and destroy them, so that there aren't any good wood stoves available, at least not nearly as many as there would have been, available for sale. Then we're going to eventually outlaw the old ones, too. We'd rather have you freeze, in other words. You might think you'd be willing to breathe a little bit of smoke in order to keep your you-know-what from freezing off, but we are so concerned about your lungs. We don't care about if you breathe radioactive fallout from Fukushima, but we don't want you breathing a little wood smoke. You know, we're so concerned. Again, folks, when you see the contradictions here, you do the difference engine thing. You look at what they're saying, and you look at the economic truth, and you realize, oh, yeah, their lips are moving, and I already know what that means. Robert says Washington is probably destabilizing Venezuela, for example. They don't like the Venezuelan government because it's not cooperative with the elite that runs the country. So there are more and more countries that are beginning to stand up to Washington. Washington wants to overthrow regimes, he thinks, in Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Russia. Countries are standing up to America, though, getting in the way of its agenda. Indeed, though, there's a broader reason to destabilize other currencies, and that's because, as we've already mentioned, it supports the dollar. If you've been creating $1 trillion or $1,000 billion new dollars a year, everyone knows the Fed's balance sheet has grown dramatically in a very short time. Well, it raises concerns, to put it mildly, about the value of the dollar. So it helps if you can destabilize other currencies, because everybody starts thinking, well, as bad as the dollar is, look at what's happening to them. They're even worse. So we'll go back to the dollar because it's the only place that's safe. Because those crooks, they're nastier than the other crooks, and I can trust them to be good crooks. A lot of stories early this week. We'll do these things, bang, 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 and then we'll I see the comment on the screen from Lori. She's right. It's cash for clunkers all over again. It's a very effective policy. By the way, we saw the same thing with used cars before the cash for clunkers programs. It used to be the good used cars would get exported to places like Costa Rica where there wasn't a native car manufacturing. But now what they're doing is just destroying them. Anything to prop up the market and force people not to be able to afford a good used car, they have to have a new one. Oh, and why? Well, we saw out of Europe this week, Europe wants to be able to have its common police state to shut any car down. Well, how do they make sure that we can shut the new cars down? We either mandate that everybody put a box in place. Well, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? We can't do that. We'll just put it surreptitiously in the new cars. By the way, it's probably in American cars by now. They've already can track where people are going, and they're easier to shut down with the electronics in a number of ways anyway. So if we can get everybody to be required by hook or by crook, because we take the old ones off the market and then we destroy the ones that they've got, well, pretty soon we've got the new ones out there, and guess what? They're all controlled. We know who you are, we know where you're going, and we can tax you by the mile, and we can shut you down if we want. So it's all about control, and it's all about manipulating the market and making sure that the only things that are available out there in the used market are the ones that we can control, regulate, shut down, destroy. When we want to, we can shut it all down, cut it all off. Speaking of which, back to the economic situation. Banks are deploying capital controls by stealth. Now, this I've talked about for a long time, too. And in the last week, we had stories out of China. Now, later that story was denied. There was a story out of Russia that one of their biggest banks was declining to let people withdraw large amounts of cash. Had the story out of the HSBC Bank, which is a British bank, but it has branches all over the place. They were going to tell people that you cannot withdraw large amounts of cash. 3,000 pounds was the limit. And when you do want to withdraw cash, you have to tell Big Brother, us, why you want it, so we can decide if it's a worthy cause. Well, hey, whose money is it? Well, we already know the answer. The law in the United States says it's not your money, and this is the same law that's been implemented in Europe already. It's a loan to the bank, and you are an unsecured creditor. You don't have the right to demand your money back because it's not yours anymore. You're calling a loan, and then now you have to wait. You may not get it at all. You may stand in line, as other creditors do. So, again, what's it saying? The whole system is poised on the verge of collapse. And Paul Craig Roberts is saying, okay, it's deliberate. And I, by the way, have been saying the same thing, too. It's just that now there's an insider who is essentially coming out and saying what, lots and lots of good analysts have been pointing out to people for years. Earlier this week, we had a major attack on gold. Not surprising. Paper gold, by the way, paper silver were hammered. They had been up above the critical levels that all the chart folks watch and say, oh, this could be a rally happening. Might be a short squeeze going on here. So what happens? Well, the plunge protection team, the Federal Reserve, come in and they smash it down. How do they do that? Well, they don't have any real gold to sell, so they sold lots and lots of paper gold. I got another story. Again, it's from Paul Craig Roberts with Dave Kranzler. It's called Why is the Fed Tapering? Now, the Fed, remember, announced they were going to taper on Wednesday. And they said this. Used to be, back in the good old days, gold price rises were held down by central banks selling or leasing gold to various bullion dealers who sold it. Well, that's all gone to China and India and places like that by now. So, the supply added to the market absorbed demand and helped hold down the price. It's exactly the opposite of what we saw when the price of natural gas spiked. You want it now, you pay more. Well, if we're going to pretend to sell thousands of tons of it that doesn't exist, we can get the price to spike down. And furthermore, we can panic people into thinking that their investment's no good and you better sell too while the getting's good. That worked for a while. But now what's happened is there's no physical supply. It's literally dried up worldwide. It's kind of like when there is no natural gas and people say, well, I'm going to burn the natural gas. I need it. You better deliver it. See, that's a whole different deal. But this week what happened, here's their paper, as the supply of physical gold diminished, increasingly recourse has been taken to selling gold short in the paper futures market. This is not the spot market. This is paper futures. But eventually it illustrates that you can manipulate prices elsewhere, downwards as well. So they pointed out that on January 30th, which is 2 days ago now, the gold price was hammered big time. It was inexplicably, at 8:20 a.m. New York time, it plunged $17 in just 30 minutes. The price plunge, says the former Treasury Secretary or Assistant, was triggered when sell orders flooded the COMEX trading floor. And then they go through the various numbers. You can look at the charts. It's very dramatic. Basically, over the average of the last few days of trading, including, mind you, the time when the Fed announced their alleged tapering, there were an average of 202 gold contracts per minute traded. But at 8:20 a.m., all of a sudden, there was a flood. There were 4 one-minute windows where over 14,000 contracts were traded. 3,424 per minute, 17 times the levels of the last few hours, including the more dramatic sessions. So basically, there was no news, there was no event driving this, and what are they saying? Well, we know what was driving it. It was deliberate. It was done on behalf of the Fed. Now, the question is why? And they spend 2 pages of the paper here talking about why it is. And by the way, the other question is, why are they no longer even concerned about hiding it? Used to be you were called a conspiracy theorist if you pointed out there was manipulation going on. But this last couple of weeks, the Financial Times, one of the most liberal papers in Europe, when it comes to economics, has come out and said, they're manipulating the gold market. But it's obvious. Well, why? Driving down the price of gold assists the Fed in its efforts to support the dollar. He's already talking about they're willing to destabilize the emerging markets of the world. Do you think they wouldn't be willing to sell gold that doesn't exist? Hey, it's great if you can get away with it. Other people that tried that, of course, would go to jail. But that doesn't happen anymore in police state America, not if you're part of the police state. Prior to the delivery period, manipulations drives the price of gold as low as possible. Oh, what happened this last week? We've just already talked about it. It's the end of the month. Contract expiration. Whole lot of big people that had sold gold didn't want to deliver it. So what's the remedy? Sell more that we can't deliver either. We'll double down and dirty. And we'll drive the price by hook or by crook low enough that we don't have to deliver gold that we haven't got anyway. So why is the Fed tapering is the other question that they ask. Well, clearly, the economy is not strong enough. The recovery is bogus. It cannot support the reduction of the so-called stimulus, but it was a lie anyway. So why not just basically pretend that we're taking away a stimulus that we already knew wasn't doing anything to begin with? Ha ha ha, aren't we clever? No other labor indicator, employment indicator, median family income indicator, real estate or retail sales indicator, new construction indicator says there's an economic recovery going on, they note. Moreover, even if there had been, it's been 4.5 years since the last recession and recovery, so it's time for a new recession anyway. The problem with all of these explanations, you know, the waste stream media explanations is that the liquidity the Fed has created has found its way into the stock and bond markets and into these emerging country economies. And when they curtail the flow of that liquidity, it will cause a crash in those markets and then bring on a new financial crisis, the exact one that they say they're trying to avoid. And Roberts has already told you part of the answer. They're not trying to avoid it. They're trying to create it because they're looking to extend and pretend, kick the can, force some of the so-called hot money flows to panic back into the dollar and let it last just a little while longer. Ultimately, what they're going to have to do, though, is realize, and when the clamor gets high enough, oh, please, 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 more QE, more QE, we need more money printing, nothing else will save us, Obi-Wan Kenobi, they'll do it. They'll get rid of the vapor taper, and they'll go right back into tapering big time. So Roberts puts it this way at the end of the story, along with this other fellow. Perhaps the feds understand that a dollar crisis is, it's perhaps an excuse for avoiding a bigger crisis. Yeah, they know that if the dollar starts to collapse because people are putting their money into the gold, that's not a good thing. So let's try to get money out of gold. Let's try to get money out of these emerging markets and prop things up for the time being. But one of two things will happen. Either there's going to be a dollar crisis or there'll be a bank crisis because the banks don't have the liquidity. They've been lying about their balance sheets, too. So he asks it this way. The big question is, will the Fed let the banks collapse, the J.P. Morgans and the Chase Manhattan, same difference, and Goldman Sachs and HSBC and all the other big banks worldwide, will they let them go in order to save the dollar? I don't think they will. I think that personally what they're going to do is collapse the dollar and that it's going to happen on purpose because they already have the next big thing in the works. But besides which, China is, of course, anxious to see the yuan become the world currency anyway, the world reserve currency. So we're seeing lots and lots of things, again, cusp, tipping point, beginning to come to a head. Now, back to emerging markets. I mentioned a couple of this. Here's a story that came out on about Thursday about India and their central bankster, a fellow named Raghuram Rajan. He's brand new. He just took over the helm. He hasn't had it easy, says one of the stories here, since taking over as India's chief money printer. What with inflation in India through the roof, and they've been trying to scapegoat gold for a long time. Remember, India has been cooperating with the international banksters and telling the Indian people, who are big, big proponents of gold, Indian wedding season, family tradition. They give the new bride and her husband gold, wedding gift. It's a nest egg. It's real money. So India is one of the biggest, has been for a long time, the biggest importer of gold in the world. They recently got passed up by China, partly because the Indian government put all kinds of new heavy tariffs and prohibitions on gold imports. So what did we see? Well, the expected thing. India became the biggest smuggler of gold. And smuggling of gold into India is far bigger now than the smuggling of drugs is. Well, here comes this new central bank head, Rajan, who said in an interview with Bloomberg TV in India the other day that, quote, international monetary cooperation has broken down. Now, what does that mean? You see, we've had the big central banks of the world cooperating and colluding to keep this game alive. Hey, we got a fiat currency, you got a fiat currency, none of these currencies are based on anything real. We know they're all fake, we know they're all fixing to come apart, but what else can we do? We have this race to the bottom going on. If I devalue my currency against yours in order to get more imports or more exports, why, you'll do the same thing, and then that's not so good. So what can we do? We can collude. We can cooperate to manipulate, and we can all agree that we hate gold and silver because those are alternatives to all of our lies. And we'll do some other things, too. Well, what India is now saying, look, you, with these emerging market things, what you've been doing is you're throwing us under the bus. We don't like being thrown under the bus. You're sacrificing our economies to keep your lie alive a little bit longer. And what he essentially said is, doing the right thing would help his people, but the other developed countries might not like some of the things that the emerging markets would have to do to cope with the new outflows that they're dealing with. They've already raised interest rates and so forth. So basically what's going on here is there's a veiled threat. Maybe India will decide, look, if you're going to play this kind of game, we're going to go ahead and let our people import gold again anyway. Hey, we're sick of the smuggling. It's counterproductive. It's kind of like your TSA. It's stupid, and we all know that it is. So they just may be allowing people to get back into gold. That's yet one more log on the fire. It's one more thing that says this gold manipulation is breaking down and it won't last either. Gerald Celente this week talked about the disastrous emerging markets and how he said that the riots that are coming will engulf the world. Okay, thank you. And essentially what he said is, so far, the taper has proceeded exactly as expected and predicted. First one in December, next one in January. How bad are things going to get for the emerging markets? Well, the sell-off, what with their currencies going down, interest rates going up, says Gerald Celente, is going to be disastrous. There are going to be riots everywhere. Now, let's get this straight. These countries are the ones that are throwing under the bus. They're having to raise interest rates in order to protect their own currencies as their economies are in decline. This is a lose-lose game. Brilliant, he says. It's exactly the opposite strategy of what needs to happen. And so, as the decline in their economies accelerates, as the Fed is sacrificing them in order to prop up the dollar, you're going to see civil unrest intensify. That's already happening in the Ukraine and in Turkey. It'll spread, says Celente, to India, to Europe. People are waking up to the corruption that's going on throughout the world. They're restless. They see how the elites are stealing almost everything and how everybody else is being left with nothing. He goes on to say the entire global financial system has been floating on the fumes of the U.S. Federal Reserve's Ponzi scheme. So, now with the Fed announcing first tapering and then the second, you can see chaos beginning to engulf the world. This chaos is extending from Russia to South Africa into China into emerging markets around the globe. The only way to stop it will be for the Federal Reserve to reverse course and do what? Untaper. Rapidly and radically increased the QE, and they got just the right woman to do it. Janet Yellen, the monster printer, ready to go. This story came out, I saw this, this came out late yesterday, I think. Yeah. I haven't asked this yet. Did you see the story? Has everybody heard about the bankster suicide epidemic that's happening around the world? Remember during the Great Depression? Give me a one if you have, two if you haven't. But do you remember during the Great Depression there were stories? Turns out that there weren't very many of them. It just takes one or two. Stories about people that lost their fortunes in the stock market collapse in 1929 and in the Great Depression, jumping out of windows. One's if you've heard about the new version of this, two's if you haven't. And it looks like we got about a mix so far of that. Well, it turns out earlier in the week, there were two of them, at least. Let's just call them, I like to call them Arkansides. Everybody know what an Arkanside is? This comes from the Clinton era. An Arkanside is the way you commit suicide in Arkansas, back when Clinton was governor. Two bullets to the back of the brain. Now, the coroner comes and says, yeah, obviously it's a suicide. Two bullets to the back of the brain. Now, there's a little joke there. Most of you will probably get it. That's tough. And that's kind of what we saw this week. Bloomberg reports that following the deaths of a J.P. Morgan senior manager on Tuesday and a Deutsche Bank senior executive on Sunday, there was another one. Russell Investments chief economist, former economist for the Fed, Mike Duker, was found dead alongside a highway in the state of Washington. Police said the death was not suspicious, they never are, and it appeared to be a suicide. He was 50. He evidently jumped over a four-foot fence and then fell down an embankment. It was suicide, of course. He'd been missing, people were looking for him, and he was a former research economist at the St. Louis Fed. Question's obvious. Why are so many folks committing suicide in the bankster community? Michael Snyder and others that are not as cynically, well, or not as blind, perhaps, are asking the question, is there a reason? Are people being offed? Are there banksters here that are literally being told, my way or the highway? And in this case, it was the highway. Other things are coming to a head, too. Obama this week. This is the only thing I'm going to talk about out of the, well, not quite the only thing, but one of the few things we'll talk about out of the police State of the Union address. I'll ask the same thing again. Give me ones on this one. If you heard about Myra, we'll type it on the screen. So if you've heard of Myra, give me a one. If you don't know what I'm talking about, give me a two. And the name has changed, but actually for at least several years, people that I respect, analysts, are saying, look, let's be real, folks. There's $5 trillion that are sitting in IRA accounts and 401k accounts around the country. Big Brother wants them. They want them bad. They've already nationalized those accounts in a lot of places. Poland most recently. Argentina's done it in the past. Lots and lots of other places have said, look, if we see people's money out there and it's just sitting there, we're going to steal it. We're not going to call it stealing. And of course, we're going to tell them that it's for your own good. We know how to manage it better than you. And that's exactly what Obama did. They're going to create a no risk but guaranteed return. Hey, how great a deal is that? Well, it doesn't get any better than that. And indeed, this one isn't that good anyway. What they're going to do is they're going to promise to give you your own money back someday with no interest. But they'll give it all back to you, maybe. All you got to do is put it in this new guaranteed government bond. And by the way, it's voluntary now, but you won't have a choice soon. They call it My Retirement Account, the Guaranteed Return, No Risk Retirement Savings Bond. Now, here's the funny part. I'm just going to WorldNet Daily, Jerome Corsi, 5-Minute Forecast. The good analysts there have been talking about this for years, saying that what this is just one more giant step towards seizing the retirement accounts of all Americans. What they'll do is they'll say, well, you used to have a self-directed IRA, but we can't trust you. You're not as wise as Big Brother. You're not almighty and all-seeing like we are, so we will invest your money for you. Going to sell all your stocks, all your bonds, everything that you've got in your retirement account, and we're going to take it instead and put it in this wonderful 0% return. Actually, it pays 0.1% return. Isn't that grand? It's not even remotely able to keep up with inflation. And that's going to be your new retirement account. Is it seizing it? Well, it's not really seizing it. It's just saying that we needed the money to keep the ship afloat a little bit longer. The Fed's tired of taking all the losses on the toxic mortgage bonds. And remember, they're coming due here this month anyway. Somebody has to buy all this toxic paper, and guess what? We can force you to do it. So, funny stuff. This was an op-ed published nationwide yesterday in all the McClatchy newspaper propaganda outlets by the Treasury Secretary, Jacob Lew, who discussed Myra and why it's such a great deal. You need to be forced into it, but we're going to call it voluntary for now. It says, I like the way the Zero Hedge introduces the story. They said the Myra Ponzi scheme introduced by Obama during the State of the Union address, with lots of behavior modifying indoctrination in the friendly press, is proceeding apace. And here's what Jack Lew in this propaganda piece said yesterday. Quote, and I'm going to be a little bit blunt here, folks, and I'm quoting him, at least for the first paragraph. You'll see when I paraphrase it a bit. Over the past 5 years, our country, he says, has accomplished a number of big things. The economy has grown stronger after being shaken to the core by the worst recession in our lifetimes. Our businesses have created more than 8 million jobs, but don't look for them yourself. The financial system is more resilient, with better protections for consumers and investors. Investments in domestic energy production have helped put the promise of American energy independence in sight, unless you count coal. And in the meanwhile, healthcare costs have grown at the slowest rate in years, while millions of families now have access to affordable healthcare coverage. If you like your doctor, you can keep it. If you like your health insurance plan, you can keep it. And here's the place where I paraphrase, folks. He should have said the following, but he didn't. And if you believe a single word of that stream of you-know-what, you're exactly the kind of rube that we intend to pluck. And then, of course, we're going to make it mandatory for everybody else. IRA confiscation is happening, says another story. Yeah, this is from Simon Black, Sovereign Man, and he basically just debunks the whole thing and says, yeah, you know, when you hear about something that's too good to be true, it is. Because Uncle Sam, he wants your hard-earned retirement savings, but he ain't such a good money manager if you look at his own budgets pretty obviously anyway. Like an unctuously overgelled used car salesman, he pitched Americans on Myra with a straight face. But the government is flat broke. We all know it. And this $5 trillion in U.S. individual retirement accounts is irresistible. So the Myra program is the first step in corralling, stealing your retirement fund. Step two, by the way, will be the bail-ins. We saw it in Cyprus and other places. What's happening around the world? Same thing. People are they're angry. In the United States, what are we seeing? Well, we saw it in the State of the Union message. We're going to disarm you people. We cannot trust you to have guns since we're fixing to steal everything that you've worked your whole lifetime for and destroy what you thought was the rule of law. And you might be getting uppity on us. We can't have uppity peons, don't you know? So what's happening elsewhere? Biggest fund withdrawals, this is from Russia today, since 9-1-1. Would it surprise you? People are taking their money out of what they thought of these hedge funds and various savings accounts. That further is putting pressure on the banks. Going to skip this story. Gold demand around the world. Mints are having to work overtime just to meet it. Things are very ugly on that score. Let's talk about what all this means. And I've kind of already alluded to it. But It's going to get even more blunt, I guess. And at this point, I'm going to do something I don't do as often, but I think probably the times call for it. I'm going to call it speculation. This is not prophecy. This may be Markology. It might be my interpretation of prophecy. If nothing else, I just call it a word to the wise. Remember, the scriptural admonition is know the times and the seasons. The men of Issachar, says the Book of Chronicles, knew the times and the seasons, so they knew what Israel should do. I see the comment on the screen, and I want to be real careful on this, Benatan and others. We are a prime, we are not peons, and I'm not saying that you are. But I am saying very clearly that so far as Big Brother is concerned, everybody who is not an insider is a peon. Understand the difference? As far as Satan is concerned, you're fodder. As far as the creator of the universe is concerned, you're his. The thing I want to keep emphasizing is make very, very sure that you know on which side of that line you sit, who you serve. Those who will not serve God, said William Penn in a famous line, will serve tyrants. As for me and my house, says Joshua, we will serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And him alone was the addition that we heard from the Mashiach. Later on, I'm going to suggest that that same pattern is very, very clear in Scripture. We have a choice. It's the essence of what I've been talking about, what I, in fact, talk about almost every week. We have a choice, and it's all about who we serve. And ultimately, we get to the point where we see that the message of Scripture is when you are faced with a choice, bow down to the demons, the idols, the prince of this world, pick a number of ways of saying the very same thing. When that becomes the choice, you better choose rightly. Don't bow down to them. Don't worship the gods of the land. Don't serve the prince of this world. Any way you choose to state it, it's the same thing. There's really only two choices. You serve the Creator or you walk in rebellion to Him. Whether you believe that there's a devil or demons isn't the point. There clearly is a Creator of the universe, and He has given us instruction. And either we walk in obedience to that or we walk in rebellion to it. And I will put it this way. If you're not walking in obedience to Him, whether you know it or not, you're walking in obedience to something very different. And that something very different is being revealed very clearly. So, when I use the term peon, I want to make sure that that you understand what we're talking about here. If you go back and look at history, this is a feudalist system. You can call it Nazi, public-private partnership. You can call it oligarchy. There's all kinds of words, but basically it's good old Middle Ages feudalism. It wasn't unique to the Middle Ages. But the idea is the king owns everything. The king's word is law, period. You look at the situation in Britain. It is still this way. Any good British subject of the crown that has an understanding of their law will tell you, yeah, that's what it is. The queen, in this case, she owns everything. All land in Britain is owned by the monarchy, period. But then you got your lords and your vassals, and they are given their little fiefdoms. And then, there's a regular sequence, right, of viscounts and dukes and other lords of the manor all the way on down the chain. I don't even remember what order. It's kind of like, you know, corporals serving lieutenants, serving captains, serving generals on up the chain. The feudal system is a hierarchy. The king owns it all. The various lords have their little fiefdoms. And at the bottom of the chain, you have the proletariat in the Soviet system or the peons in the feudal system. These are people that, whether they know it or not, don't own anything. We see the same thing. We just talked about it in terms of Pharaoh, who owned the land in Mitzrayim. And those people, they had to pay 20% to Pharaoh. Hey, a modern peon would be thrilled to get off so lightly. So what I'm telling you is, yeah, you better understand who you serve, because the default assumption of the prince of this world is, unless you make it clear that you know that you serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and him alone, this world is going to assume you're a peon and you serve him. So is that clear? I hope that's as clear as I can make it. When I say the term peon, folks, I want you to bristle. I want you to say, that's not me. And I say, great. Now make sure the world sees it and knows it. Let me put it this way, quoting from this week's portion. Speak to the B'nai Israel. Hey, are you one of those or not? Are you grafted in? Are you in by birth? Doesn't matter. The point is, you can choose. Speak unto the B'nai Israel that they take for me an offering. Of every man whose heart makes him willing, you shall take my offering. Is that us? If it is, folks, make your offering. Make it in gold and silver and blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen and in the sweat of your brow and in the offerings of your intellect and in the things that you choose to do for him and to build with one another. All of that is key. There's an old saying, too, that paints the other side of this same coin. If you don't know your rights, you don't have any. So I'm going to come to that in a minute, but that's a great comment. I appreciate that. And so when I use the word peon, again, I want you to bristle, and I want you to say, that's not me. But most importantly, folks, it's not good enough to say it to yourself. It needs to be visible in your fruit, in your actions, that others will see and know by the things you wear, by the way that you comport yourself, by the words of your mouth, and by the things you do, that you serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. It really is that important. Okay. Let's ask a question. This is a timely question. It's already come up this morning at least once among the text questions. Most of you saw what happened in Atlanta. Was what we would call in Denver or in Wisconsin or in a number of the places in the Midwest a little minor flurry of winter snow. They got a measly 3 inches, little ice associated with it, no big deal. Well, unless you're not used to it, unless you're critically, terminally even, unprepared for it. Now, does snow ever happen in Atlanta? Yeah, it does. Doesn't happen very often. They got some snow removal equipment. They don't seem to know how to do it. The people don't know how to drive. Am I being critical for that reason? Well, not necessarily, but I do think this is a good warning, and that's the key. So literally, I saw pictures of what some were calling one of the most dramatic and major traffic jams in United States history in Atlanta this last week. Schools were closed. People spent the night at their workplaces and kids on the floor of school buildings and so forth. And the TV news had all kinds of pictures. You can go find them online of the horrible, horrible snowstorm. I'm looking at these pictures and going, come on. This is something you see every week or so in Denver or in any of the major cities where they get snow all the time. Nothing to panic about. That's the key. Nothing to panic about. Now, the reason people panic is because if only one person in two doesn't know how to drive and panics and leaves their car along the side of the road or parks it in the middle of the road and gets out and runs, you got a problem. The roads are blocked. I don't care how good of a driver you are, you're stuck. And guess what? We're seeing the same thing with the economy. I'm suggesting this is a metaphor for the bigger problems on the horizon. Yeah, and that's especially true. I see the comments on the screen. If we're headed for a little mini ice age, we already know that Al Gore and others who are talking about man-made global warming have been lying through their teeth for at least 15 years. And now we're finding out, oh, look, we've got natural gas plants forcing prices of electricity and natural gas to spike higher. We're shutting down coal plants because of this bogus, non-existent global warming. People are going to pray for global warming pretty soon. And they're going to find out that the master of the universe is saying, oh, no, no, we got you now. The next miracle is whether or not we let you live and have any power at all. So things are getting nasty. A lot of it is by design. There's an old saying, right? Never ascribe to conspiracy that which can be explained by stupidity. And I'll tell you that when a person serves the prince of this world or the adversary or walks in rebellion to God, any way you want to phrase it, it don't matter whether it's because they're stupid or because they're evil. The effect is the same. The rest of us need to be able to say, I'm not going to go there. I choose to come out of that. I choose to serve the other master, the right one, the creator of the universe. So, I'm looking at a story by Michael Snyder, and I like Michael Snyder, I read his stuff frequently, and what struck me was funny was, literally, I had the very same thought the morning I happened to, you know, flip on the computer or look on the web and see that he had written the article that that I was already fixing to talk about on the news anyway, and the headline pretty well tells the story, and I've already outlined it. If 3 inches of snow can cause this much chaos in Atlanta, what will the coming economic collapse look like? Answer, you now have your clue. Now, going to change gears again. I'm going to talk about the State of the Union. Probably not the way you think. Forget what the emperor, the man who would be king, the man with the almighty pen, the man who doesn't need no stinking Congress and doesn't care what the Bill of Rights says. Forget all of that jazz. The real State of the Union, I will suggest to you, we've already outlined a whole bunch of it. It's deliberately bad. It's evil. It's getting worse. It's destruction by design. It's exactly the opposite of what this Torah portion is talking about. Get people together. Yeah, they've seen miracles. That hasn't helped them grow up. Now get them to build, to bring an offering of their own stuff so that they can grow up, so that they can learn to work together, so that they can do something for the almighty creator of the universe. What are we seeing instead? Big Brother can do it for you. I got a program for this, a program for that. You can't have a job, but what we don't make a job. If there's a problem with jobs in the United States, we need Big Brother to fix it. If there's a problem with energy, Big Brother will fix it. If there's a problem with the currency, Big Brother's already fixed it. Ha ha ha, you just don't know about that. And so forth and so on. If there's a problem with terrorism, we'll fix it. We'll make terrorism like you never dreamed of before. We'll bring it to your front door. And so forth and so on. It's about destruction. Again, the exact opposite. Dependency. Rather than teaching people to do something for God, they're going to teach them that, no, no, the God of this world will do something for you. You don't have to do anything for yourself. You're nothing but a ward of the state. So here's the story that I will suggest. You want the State of the Union? I got about four of them here, but this one is the primary first example. In Texas this week, a Fort Worth, Texas police officer who killed a 72-year-old man. The term is murder, folks. He murdered. Well, maybe it's manslaughter because he was stupid. But anyway, he saw a guy in his own driveway with a gun. Now, the cop, he was on his way to a burglar alarm that was going off somewhere in the neighborhood. But what this stupid cop didn't know was he was at the wrong place. Am I being really hard on this guy? Just wait, folks. I'm not as hard as I'm going to be. And by the way, is it his fault? No, he's just been poorly trained. He's been deliberately mistrained. It's part of the problem. So, he sees a guy in his own driveway with a gun. Well, remember, here's this word again, peons. Peons aren't allowed to have guns. They don't know how to use a gun like we, the almighty masters of the universe. They don't have the same kind of training in no hesitation killing that we do. So what did this highly trained officer of the police state do? Well, you got it. He whipped out his licensed gun and blew that sucker away. He shot that 72-year-old man 7 times, killed him dead right there in his own driveway, and it took him a while. He had to wait for the guy to show up and draw a chalk line around the body, a detective, to figure out that he wasn't even at the right place. Where was the right place? Well, it was the house across the street where the 72-year-old man had gotten his gun and had started to walk across the street to help out his neighbor, who just might have a problem. So for his trouble, the 72-year-old man is gunned down. Well, so here's the rest of the story. A jury, or what now passes for it, a grand jury, decided that they would not indict the deputy, R.A. Alex Hooper, for the May 28th shooting death of Jerry Waller. Okay, why? Well, because the cop felt threatened. Well, there you go. If you're a minion of Big Brother, you can feel threatened and you can commit murder with impunity. And there won't be anybody put you to task for it. On the other hand, and ask yourself the question, what happens if some cops at the wrong address, and by the way, I wish I could tell you we hadn't seen this happen time after time after time, but when yours truly got a little bit, let's just say activated years ago, it was because of a case of a fellow named Ishmael Mena in Denver. I've talked about this before. I'll mention it again. We're talking late 1990s, and I remember seeing this in the Denver papers. Fellow named Ishmael Mena, a nice Hispanic surnamed fella. I don't remember how old he was, in his 60s or early 70s, sitting in his own apartment in the People's Republic of Denver one night. Cops come to the wrong house. They bust down his door, and they see Ishmael sitting in front of his TV set, and he has the temerity to pick up a can of Coca-Cola. Now, that might have killed him eventually, but the cops made sure it happened right then. A fellow named Beanie, who had not one, not two, but before he was done with the Denver PD, I'm aware of at least 5 notches in his service revolver. This Denver cop killed more than 5 people, most of them like Ishmael Mena, innocent. And he's still on the force, at least he was. Probably retired by now. With a pension. Ishmael Mena had a Coke can. Beanie felt threatened, and he blew him away. End of story. This guy felt threatened. A peon died. But hey, it's only a peon. Nothing to worry about. One of the neighbors of the dead man, who happened to be a former city council member of Fort Worth, said that the rookie, the cop, was a victim of his own inexperience. He just unloaded his gun in rapid fire. That's what I heard. It woke me up. Bang, 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 bang. There was no hesitation, she said. It was an accidental death at the hands of an untrained police officer. No, I'm going to suggest to you that's hardly true. He was highly trained. Remember, he's the only one in modern post-constitutional America that the president and most of the peons, or the rulers of the peons, say is entitled to keep and bear arms. Peons can't allow. Remember, slaves don't have rights, folks. They serve another master, remember? Their master decides what rights they have and what rights they don't have. So you got that going for you. But the most important thing here is, some of you may remember this, and I see the joke on the screen. It's true, yeah, but it's tacky for a family audience, so I didn't mention that, but it's true. Having to do with the meaning of that word. Do you remember no hesitation targets? I'm going to ask this question. Give me ones if you remember the story. We talked about it here 6 months ago or more. No hesitation targets. A one if you've heard about it, two if you don't recall or haven't heard about it. I'll give it a second. One if you've heard of no hesitation targets, two if you haven't. And while we're waiting for the lag, I'll point out to you what they are anyway. There was a company, and it was a federal contract, and they were providing these things to federal law enforcement. And I put the word sick in there, meaning, you know, it's a misnomer, but that's what they call it, because they're enforcing a whole different set of law. And to local law enforcement, and these things consisted of life-size photographs of old men holding guns in their bedroom, or old women, grandmotherly types, holding a gun in a hallway. One of the more famous ones was a 20-some-odd-year-old-looking young girl who was pregnant, holding a gun. And the idea was, everybody's heard about this almost, the idea was you got to train these law enforcement officers. They're no longer protecting and serving because they may feel threatened. And if they feel threatened, well, the life of that peon is void. Hey, because it's police safety that becomes paramount. It's the safety of the almighty minions of the state that is paramount. You peons don't matter, so far as they're concerned. And I wish I was being sarcastic, folks. I'm really not. Because when you look and see just how widespread this stuff is, it becomes clear. Now, there's a bigger point here, obviously. The no-hesitation targets were used to train officers to do exactly what this murderer named Hooper did. See a guy with a gun? He's a peon. Shoot him! Bang, 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 bang! Unload the gun! Kill him dead! Worry later about what the consequences are. You're not going to be held guilty anyway. Remember, you're one of the masters of the universe. You're above the law. You got the 007 license to kill. And that's exactly what he did. And I ask the question because, you know, if you were in Ishmael Mena's place, now Ishmael Mena, of course, he didn't have a gun, he just had a Coke can, but he was just as dead because Beanie felt threatened. So let's talk about what happens all too often in modern America. They bust down the door, probably the wrong house, or maybe it's just that they have a confidential informant who's looking to get off, and he gives somebody a name. Doesn't matter. We don't need two corroborating witnesses. We don't need a warrant anymore. We just need somebody pointing a finger. That's enough. And they'll go bust down a door. They'll shoot your dog, too, on the way in. So picture some person, like this 72-year-old man, Waller, maybe sitting in his bedroom, laying in his bed, might even be asleep. He hears the door burst down, or the glass break. He hears a smashing of feet. He sees flashlights pointed at the walls. Bang, bang. Now his dog's dead, and somebody busts down the door. He reaches for a gun. He reaches for a flashlight. He reaches for an aspirin. And they come through the door, and they feel threatened. He's dead. Oh, well, another peon. We have a name for it, right? Collateral damage. We can do it with drones nowadays, too. And then you can do it from a distance, and the minion of the state doesn't even have to feel too guilty about it. Hey, he just pushed a button, saw it on a TV screen. It's not quite the same impact, you know. I guess you can put a gun on your TV monitor. You know, folks, again, it's hard not to be disgusted at this kind of stuff, but what I'm suggesting to you is, you want a real indication of the State of the Union? It's the police State of the Union. Let's do some compare and contrast. Remember the difference engine concept. Here's another story. Tell me the differences. Police Chief Shane Harger was detained and harassed by federal agents because he had the temerity to travel to a constitutional convention. He was going to something that's run by a guy that I know well, Sheriff Richard Mack, former sheriff of Arizona, Graham County, Arizona. And I've pleased to meet Richie on a number of occasions and interviewed him and everything else. He's a good guy. He runs a group that is dedicated towards informing police officers and military officers and military grunts and everybody in between that you took an oath before God to the Constitution and to the law. Have you read the law? Do you know the God you're serving? And what this guy was doing, this police chief, he was going to Las Vegas, where the latest CSPOA convention was taking place. When he went there, he was finally allowed to go. He pledged again to do what he'd already pledged to do, to observe, obey and observe the U.S. Constitution. And he also refused to carry out unconstitutional orders like gun confiscation and complying with unconstitutional, non-existent warrants and violations of the Fourth Amendment without probable cause. In other words, he was doing what every good officer ought to do. Honoring his oath before God. There are a lot of these good folks. Now, don't get me wrong. When I talk about the criminal murderers, like that last guy, who was trained to kill without hesitation, so maybe we shouldn't blame him. Maybe we should say it was his bad parenting by the almighty state. But nevertheless, the point is, there are good cops. There are a lot of them. Praise Yah for that. And what's happening to them is exactly what's not happening to this murderer in Fort Worth. Police Chief Shane Harger of Jemez Springs, New Mexico, when he tried to fly out of Albuquerque, was harassed, first by TSA, who demanded to see his credentials, and then by an unnamed so-called federal agent. At least he claimed to be a federal agent, demanded to see his credentials too, and told him he was a person of interest. Where are you going and why? How dare you go there? Well, he was detained for 35 minutes, getting a little taste of Big Brother's displeasure with what he was doing and who he was. And for crying out loud, who does he think he is, going to obey God instead of the state? Yeah, I mean, a little sarcastic. You catch that, I'm sure. When he got back the very next day, he was placed on administrative leave, fired, and ordered by the Sandoval County, New Mexico sheriff to disband his entire police department. Most of them were volunteers due to political affiliations. In other words, he was targeted for federal harassment, made a person of interest, and subsequently suspended for reaffirming his belief before another master in a set of law that no longer applies. And again, I'm going to compare and contrast. Look at the difference here. One fellow commits murder, kills a peon. Well, there you go. Thankfully, you got a paid vacation, at least. Another fellow dares to say that he serves the creator of the universe and believes that the Constitution still applies. He's out of a job. He is suffering the wrath of the new Almighty. Another piece from the State of the Union address. Obama has pledged to enact gun control laws, you've already guessed this, with or without Congress. He doesn't need the constitutional authority to do anything. He'll just act unilaterally. I was disgusted because I saw a number of Congress critters, I won't name them today, I have in the past, who basically one of them got up and walked out. Another one tweeted that this is nasty, he's acting like a dictator, and yet none of them had the chutzpah to do what, if they are serving in Congress at least, they should have done, which is to file articles of impeachment. They say he's a dictator, they walked out, where's the action? Where's the follow-up? Where's the do, rather than just merely talk? I got two more, I guess, police state stories. Bitcoin exchange operators, a couple fellows that are operating Bitcoin mining operations, were arrested in what was called a political persecution. They face 50 years in the Huascao, the federal pen, because they dare to, operate an alternative to the almighty reserve currency of the world, the dollar. And if they're willing to destabilize small countries and cause riots in the emerging nations around the world, putting a few Americans in jail for a bogus charge shouldn't be a problem, should it? They're just peons anyway. And finally from D.C., another peon was shot and killed. You know about this one. A family of a young, pregnant, young mother, 34-year-old woman, was shot to death by federal agents in the shadow of the Capitol in front of the White House. And her family is filing a lawsuit. Basically, the guy that is representing her is former New York PD cop. And the more you see about that story, the more you realize, and you probably heard about this one, the woman was, she panicked. And she was afraid they're going to kill her anyway, and sure enough, they ended up doing it. And if we lived in a nation of law and not of men, the woman should never have been shot at. She was shot at in a public street. She was executed. And they've evidently, that seems to be the evidence here, modified the police reports. At least the initial police reports didn't say things that the later police reports are saying. Okay. Hey, Jeff, give me a quick, do we need to quit by... in 2 minutes, or can we go a little bit longer? Where are you at today? Just put it on the screen. And because otherwise I got someplace that I was intending to go that we won't make it. It'll take a second for all that to appear. Yeah, if it's all right, let me just say it. Yeah, okay, thank you. Because I think we do need to talk about this today. I'm going to go here first. And this is something I've hammered a couple times over the last few days, but I think it's important. I actually mentioned it last weekend, too. The Super Bowl. Bread and circuses, the modern Roman Empire version of the Colosseum. Super Bowl fans, says an article from earlier in the week, will encounter, or may encounter, but they're going to be out there anyway, Viper teams. Viper, if you haven't heard, is the TSA's newest unconstitutional rape of the American peons. And they have named these things Visible Intermodal Prevention and Response Teams, Viper Teams. Hey, how in your face is that, right? You know the Hebrew word for a snake or a viper or a serpent, nechash? You want a satanic image? You don't have to look much further. Basically what they're telling you is, look, it's pretty well obvious that what we're doing in airports isn't about security. It's about security theater. It's about showing you who's boss. And because a lot of you simply are saying, well, I'm not going to travel by airplane anymore because I'm sick and tired of being treated like a slave and groped and microwaved and worse, having my stuff stolen and being forced to put up with watching my children treated like slaves or worse. So I'm not going to get on an airplane. Well, so we're going to do it on buses. We're doing it on trains. Ah, see, you like that? Oh, and by the way, you want to go to a football game? Well, it's been done at football games before, but this one's really big. So we're going to put the biggest police presence that the American formerly free public has ever seen coming up Sunday. And on its official blog site, TSA announced that they'll be conducting security, Achtung, not only at the entrance to MetLife Stadium in New Jersey, but at, quote, local transportation venues, including commercial and general aviation facilities and mass transit in the form of the infamous satanic, I said it, Viper squads. That's just the adversary, right? Adversary to the Constitution in this case. Super Bowl fans may encounter Viper teams all along the way. Most fans are getting to the stadium via mass transit, so they will encounter them there. Football fans should arrive early to accommodate the enhanced anti-constitutional security procedures. People are being told this is just a normal way of life in the police state of the union. In addition to random bag searches and other checkpoints being set up all over, not only New Jersey, but New York, choppers will patrol the skies, NFL policy requiring all attendees to bring their belongings in clear bags. Also cements the fact that citizens are quite literally now regarded as guilty until proven innocent. Food, merchandise, seat cushions, and beverage will be meticulously irradiated so that if there was any food value in them before, there sure ain't afterwards prior to entering the stadium. Is it any wonder, says this piece from Prison Planet in conclusion, why 18,000 Super Bowl tickets still remain unsold? Why the change? That's a good question. I'm not sure, but I can kind of hazard a guess, Snake Stomper. Super Bowl used to be in New Orleans all the time. I guess it's not enough just to get the New Orleans peons accommodated to the idea that they are slaves of the police state. Where better to go next than New York and New Jersey, where they can show people, hey, see, look, you too are at the heart of the police state. We'll need to move it around if the nation survives long enough to have a couple more of these. Got to have a coliseum in all the local places where all the local peons can get indoctrinated. And I wish that was, you know, again, I know a lot of this sounds sarcastic. I'm going to try to make it clear. It's not nearly as sarcastic as the truth is, because the truth is pretty nasty in this point. Now, I'm working up. I got two more stories here that I want to do. Some of you have heard me talk about this one. I talked about it last night, too. I mentioned I'd repeat some things. And this one I'm going to repeat because I think all of this stuff is so important that it bears repeating. And I know that among those of us online, if we took a poll, there are folks that would say, well, I don't believe in demons and I don't believe in devils or maybe Hasatan. You know, I've joked about it, talked about it. I have a good friend who is a well-known Orthodox rabbi, and I've pointed out his comments on Hasatan, the adversary. And basically it boils down to, hey, he's, as far as the traditional Jewish view, Mark, he is a company man. You want to understand the Jewish understanding of Hasatan, the adversary? He's a company man. Picture a sleazy New York lawyer in a three-piece suit and wingtip shoes, spewing venom and lies all the while with a great big smile and a fancy gold watch. That's your Hasatan. Forget the Christian image of the little guy with horns and a pitchfork. Okay, I'm fine with that. What does Hasatan mean? Really, it just means the adversary. Are there demonic forces in the world? Are there real demons? I personally believe very much, because I will suggest to you that I have seen things that have convinced me. Others don't. That's okay. But I'll suggest to you that if you don't necessarily believe in demons or their effects, you missed the Grammy Awards. Check out the replay, or maybe don't. I'm looking at pictures here because, unfortunately, folks, we'll put the website up on the screen in a minute. You can go look at this one. This one too is from it's a replay. It's a link from Vigilant Citizen, and they got pictures. They got pictures of Beyonce's performance. These are not for kiddies, by the way. Not, that's K-I-D-D-I-E-S, not kitties, which are also in the pictures here. And they got pictures of Katy Perry, and they got pictures of things that unless you see them, you might not even believe that I'm telling you the truth here. The headline says, the Grammy Awards 2014, still pushing the Illuminati agenda. This year's Grammy Awards had something for everybody. At least they had something for everybody that serves another master. For years, says the author, people have known that the awards ceremonies are a celebration of what the Illuminati industry stands for. They're choreographed. But this one really took the cake. Now, the funny thing about it, and the thing I'm going to point out to you that you can hear in genuine print without seeing the pictures, are the commentaries from some of the pretty much mainstream Hollywood observers. Now, so get this. The first one I'm going to read is from E! Online. E! Is the online Hollywood kind of entertainment industry insider gossip station, right? And the E! Online guy said, quote, did we just witness actual witchcraft during Katy Perry's Grammy performance? And there was another tweet, same source here. Is it just me or some of the Grammy performances so far out really demonic? Looks like there's a lot of evil in the world. The author goes on to say, well, we knew that these awards from the beginning wouldn't be child-friendly. Dressed in a leotard revealing most of her bootyliciousness, Beyoncé's performance was as sexual as the lyrics of the song that she sang. Parents were complaining about why was this televised at 8 p.m. while children, many of whom still look up to Beyoncé, were awake. Others talked about Miley Cyrus and so forth. But hey, folks, they were just getting started. The most blatant part of the awards were undoubtedly Katy Perry's performance, which was so blatant it caused even many of the non-aware viewers to be disturbed by its obviously satanic undertones. The performance began when a sinister voice sang, "She casts spells from crystal balls, invoking spirits. She puts me in a trance." Inside the crystal ball on stage, Perry sings while four horned, demon-like figures rise above her with Baphomet-like sinister apparitions. She then gets out of the crystal ball, moves around with the backup dancers, remotely controlling them as if they were under her spell. And quickly we understand the song is not about love, but it's about being under occult possession. Then Katy summons a dark horse. And the pictures make it clear what the text says, too. Now, some of you have seen the evil, demonic devil horse, as the locals call it, at DIA. This is an absolutely satanic-looking thing. I mean, it's about as nasty of a sculpture as you'll ever see in public, of this great big horse rearing up on its hind legs. It's blue, and it's kind of a particularly ugly shade of blue, and it's got great big eyes. This sucker stands at least 20 feet tall, right outside the entrance to Denver International Airport, and it's got red eyes that reflect the sun in the daytime and glow with a demonic evil light at night. And the same red horse appeared next on the stage with Katy Perry, who then danced around a witch's broom turned stripper pole for a while. Then finally, her backup dancers lit a circle of fire around her. You get the impression. When it was all said and done, there was a performance of 33, a symbolic Illuminati number of couples, I'll put that in quotes, homosexual couples being wed by Queen Latifah. And along came Madonna, the grand priestess, to sing her song about gay love entitled, I don't remember, something else in here, but a same love, it was called. So it was, it was an evening with something for everybody. At least something that pretty well reveals it. So what I'm suggesting is the following. And I don't think it takes that much suggestion to look out and see it. We have a nation which has a TSA that is so blatantly raping the Bill of Rights and conditioning people that, hey, it's just the way it goes. You live in this society, we're going to expose your nakedness. We're going to fondle your wife's breasts. We're going to look and see what you look like under those clothes. Ha, ha, ha. And let's not kid each other. We know it's a lie. We know the machine doesn't work. It's got nothing to do with terror unless, of course, you understand who the real terrorists are. It's us, and you are the peons. So that's message one. Then you've got message two, having to do with the economy. We know it's melting down. We know that we've pretty well raped the entire world economy. We know that we've pretty well gotten as much blood out of that turnip as we can, but we're not going to give up until we got every last drop. And we're willing to sacrifice the emerging markets. We're willing to steal your hard-earned retirement accounts. We've already been taking people's houses. And we're going to disarm folks around the world so that they're more able to have this done to them and less able to fight back. If we feel threatened, we will kill the peons. You want to know the State of the Union? It's a police state. And finally, if all else fails, we want you to understand just who we serve. We've hidden it for a while. We've kidded about it. We've made it seem like, oh, it's just good, honest, wholesome entertainment. It got less wholesome over the years. It got more and more satanic, more and more in opposition to the Creator. We started licensing things that he says are abomination. If we say they're okay, they're okay. Not only are they okay, for example, male-on-male, homosexual, so-called marriage, but if you don't like it, we'll destroy your business. We'll destroy your reputation. You will, if you serve the state, be required to hire people, regardless of what you think your God may have to say about it. Or because your business belongs to us. Your home belongs to us. Understand that, peon. In other words, folks, the message is as clear as it can get. And now, between the Grammy Awards and then the same week coming up on the Satanic Super Bowl, you know what the halftime presentation is going to look like, don't you? I mean, just look at the precedent of the last couple years. This one's going to be one to write home about. And it may be followed up with a false flag. Who knows? There certainly is lots and lots and lots of talk about it. There are lots and lots of rumors. I don't have any doubt, as an observer for a long time, of what's going on, that the plans are in place. The question is just whether or not the man with the pen will decide to pull the plug on it. Or somebody else will. And guess what? All of these security procedures, they're as bogus as the TSA stuff. It's not designed to prevent such an attack. It's designed to make sure that if the word is given, that the peons inside will know who's the real boss. So it's so in your face. We're talking again today about the deconstruction. We're not building something for God. We're tearing down what God has allowed to be built and replacing it with something that he calls abomination on every front, whether it's idolatry, or preventing him from being in the schools, or the God-given rights that at one time the law of the land was supposed to protect. Indeed, that was the purpose of government as it was once constituted. All of that kind of stuff. More and more and more in your face, in your face. There's an expression that you'll see used more than once in Scripture. They are without excuse. People that can't get it by now. Right? You've heard me quote Isaiah 66 many, many times. Because when I called, no one answered. They chose that in which I did not delight. Do not delight. I will choose their delusions, and I'll bring their fears upon them. Hey, people that are afraid of terror, they're going to be living under it day by day as they serve the other master, as they watch the TV and they see the gods that they worship right there in the most blatant, in the most... Well, what's the term I'm looking for? Yeah, you want the image of what most people would think of as satanic, and they're giving it to you. Is it real? Doesn't matter. The point is, people can't argue that, well, I didn't know that it was satanic, because Katy Perry told us. The Super Bowl guys told us. Got one more story, and I'll wrap it with this one. And then we'll go back and we'll make sure that it's clear. All the pieces fit, hopefully. If there's questions, if there's things I've missed, this is a time to put them on the screen too. This is from a guy that I like, have had a number of communications with. Legal Reality is the name of his, I guess you'd call it a ministry, mission. As a former attorney in Texas named Harmon Taylor, who turned in his bar card and essentially has been preaching a similar message. It's kind of a come out of her my thing, but he talks about it in a very, very legal sense, and he tells people things that they don't want to hear for the most part. We all stop being constitutionalists, says a newsletter that was dated yesterday from Harmon. If we will take advice from God via his beast system, and stop looking at the Constitution as even a means by which to limit the beast system, then we'll learn at an increasingly accelerated rate to defend ourselves against this current and present beast system. So he's talking about the beast. He puts that term in quotes every time, right? Reference to the beast of Revelation. And it's a good metaphor, but I'm going to come back to it in just a second. I'm going to lay out his thesis. Some of you have heard me talk about it, and I'm about 99% in agreement. I'm going to make one or two minor distinctions as we go through it this here, because there are several ways to phrase exactly what he's saying, and I want to make sure everybody understands it so that it's clear. Down this path, and in this immediate context, understand something. Federal means federal. Another way of saying by agreement. What are we talking about in the Torah? Covenant. Covenant is by agreement. What did Esau do? He sold his birthright for a cup of pottage by agreement. What did Ben Franklin, in a secular sense, warn about 200 plus years ago? Those who would trade essential liberty for a little temporary security deserve neither. What's the trade? It's by agreement. So what he's telling us here is this. The federal system, as he says, was not created by any constitution, so it is not limited by any constitution either. Now, what Harmon argues is the Constitution does not apply. It's a dead letter. And on that score, I agree. Now, I frequently refer to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. You've probably heard me say something today several times about how nasty what's going on is. But remember, I also talk about this idea of difference, distinction. You want to understand the truth? Compare. Compare two things that seem similar and ask yourself, what's wrong with this picture? Why don't these things agree? Why doesn't the Bill of Rights apply anymore to the peons? Why do you have a dictator on TV saying, I don't care what Congress says. I don't care what your Fourth Amendment says about illegal search and seizure, warrantless searches, or the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. You don't have those rights. See? So I'll ask people the question, well, you think there's a Constitution. They tell you there's a Constitution, but why doesn't it apply to you? Harmon's answer is because it doesn't really exist. It never really did. And he can show that in history. I'll point out to you, I don't so much care. Now listen carefully. Because all you need to do is ask the question, why doesn't it apply to me now? In order to see the answer. And he's telling you here, it's because it's by agreement. Because if they don't know who you serve, and I mention this frequently, it's called precedent and presumption. The prince of this world will presume, this is a legal term, that you belong to him. Remember, he's the prosecuting attorney here. He's got the fancy suit on. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. Failure to object in a timely fashion is acquiescence. You could have objected, you didn't. You went along. Well, hey, gotcha! By agreement means by agreement. Now, the other term that I will use is private law. In other words, whether there is a constitution or not, and I think there is, actually, and it once applied. Other things have been done to it. You can look at other books, and we've talked about them over the years, you know, on Shabbat from time to time. People like L.B. Bork have written about the 14th Amendment, how it's been done, the idea of emergency powers and all the other things associated with the banking system. It's a great big picture. It's a cult, but it's hidden in plain sight. We're talking about the same thing in a whole bunch of different ways. And it really does boil down to the simple, you know, formula that I've given any number of times. Choose this day whom you will serve. We serve God, or we serve the most evil, nasty, satanic, big brother, prince of this world, police state that you can possibly imagine. And ultimately, there's no in between. Because those who serve him are bound by his commandments, statutes, judgments, instruction. Don't bear false witness. Don't murder. Don't steal. Honor. Do what you say you'll do. Keep your oaths. Put me first. Love your neighbor as yourself second. All that stuff. And the alternative? Do as thou wilt. Don't keep your oaths. You want to kill? You're above the law. You got your veto pen? You got your pen to write law? You're the king. Master of the universe. Pharaoh. Emperor. Baphomet, Molech, doesn't matter. Any other choice except that one will do, and all those roads lead to the same place. So, back to Harmon Taylor, because it helps to put all this stuff in perspective. And again, why is it important now? Because we're coming up on the cusp, the tipping point. Our Creator is saying it's time for an offering. Take from me a truma from those, all those with a willing heart. Gold, silver, blue and purple thread, scarlet, or just the sweat of your brow, the offerings of your lips, the things that you can do in teaching or in building for me. Serve me and learn. Serve the prince of this world and destroy. It's a simple choice. So back to the Constitution, where Taylor says, these constitutionist attorneys, those people who have believed that that thing still applies, they mean well. We've all been raised to drink from that same poisoned well, but people just don't get it yet. So here's his summary of what he is trying to make clear, and what I will try to make clear too. That police chief, remember we talked about him? Guy in New Mexico, targeted by the feds, addressed below. He simply doesn't understand it yet. That rights exist. Now listen carefully. Not because there's a constitution or a Bill of Rights. Now this is something I talk about frequently. The whole point of the Bill of Rights is not that this thing gives people rights or creates rights. All of the founders understood the rights pre-exist. We are endowed by these rights by our Creator. And the whole purpose of the government is to secure these rights. That's why governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. The point of the Bill of Rights, in other words, is to say, look, here are some specifically enumerated things that thou shalt not do. You central government, you. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or the freedom of the press, or of speech, or of worship, or the right of the people to freely assemble and petition government for redress of grievances. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And that thing about warrants, no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation. Does any of that still apply? I mean, seriously, not one word of what I just quoted still applies. Why? By agreement. Because when people have signed up to serve another master, they go to bread and circuses. They'll go to the Coliseum on Sunday. They'll see the Super Bowl. And they'll see Big Brother's power and his protection. Oh, and if Big Brother doesn't protect you, you are fodder for the terrorists. Somebody will blow their underwear up and kill you. And then we'll take your stuff anyway. Do you see who the real God is that's being served? And if you didn't, right? Catch the replay of the Grammys. It's all there. And if you're a Buddhist or a Jehovah's Witness or whatever else, got some different thing. They got another God that you can see that's antithetical to whatever it is that'll scare you to. Right? It's all about bringing their fears upon them. Harmon calls it the beast system. It's a perfectly good way of putting it. It's literally, whether it's Nebuchadnezzar in the Tanakh, Or the other empires, the Medes and the Persians and the others that followed the Babylonians, later the Greeks and then the Romans, all the world empires, all of whom worshipped other gods, all of whom were allowed by the Creator to do exactly what he threatened to do and indeed said he would do. If you walk contrary to me, bad stuff will happen. You'll fall back into bondage, right back where you started. It'll be worse. You'll be stripped naked. My wife will know. Why? These things are happening. He allows the beast to come. We're seeing the beast. And man, the beast is, he's there. It's about as undeniable as any of us can say we've ever seen in our whole lifetimes. And it's going to probably come to a climax on Sunday. Maybe not a climax, but a mini lead up to what's coming next, which will probably be worse still. So he says, back to Harmon Taylor, the Bill of Rights is horribly mislabeled because even if the language that exists there would constitute what he calls admissible evidence of law, right? If you could bring it into a court, and by the way, for the most part, you can't, even though the judges have taken an oath to support it, it's not admissible in court. Isn't that funny? Which it's not. It still doesn't establish or grant rights to anyone. In the same way that the Magna Carta is horribly mislabeled as Bill of Rights oriented. All that Magna Carta did was add limits to the exercise of the supreme power of the king. See, do you follow? This is a very important distinction. Again, it's all about who we serve. And it's all about the fact that if we serve the Creator of the universe, our rights come from him. Our choice is to serve him. And when we enter into agreements, well, what did Joshua? He was told, don't enter into any agreements with the land, with the people of the land, with their gods. It'll be a snare to you. Well, it is. But when we enter into agreements with good people, they honor their oaths. These criminals, these Cretans, these liars, whether they're used or just deliberately evil, again, doesn't matter. If they're serving the wrong master, once we discern that, we don't enter into agreements with them or with their gods. The whole point, of course, of the Bill of Rights was to put limits on them and to say, look, because men are fallen, and we know this, that was the traditional Christian understanding. Men are fallen. They're by nature. Cannot be trusted. So, what did Jefferson say? Bind them down with the chains of the Constitution. Well, those chains are no longer doing anything. So the key here is to understand. The rights don't come from this piece of paper. That's why Obama's pen can't get rid of them. People have already given them up by agreeing to serve such a man who's not even, doesn't meet the requirements of the Constitution. And as the Torah says, you don't put a foreigner over you. Don't serve him. Samuel was told by God, hey, they've not rejected you for being king over them, Samuel. They have rejected me. This whole thing is about me. It's about choosing another master. Same old story, folks. Nothing new. So, the basis for the limits is the recognition of rights, he says, but the language doesn't create rights. Rights come from God, not from man. They pre-existed Magna Carta. They pre-exist the Bill of Rights. So, what these things really should have been called instead is additional prohibitions on the central government. Thus, the thing to know is this. This is where I'll end. In order to have rights, one must assert them consistently, constantly, continuously. And to what Herman says, I'll add one more thing that I think is even more important. We have to know, we have to understand where they come from and who we serve. And if it's not clear, it's got to be clear to us first. If I don't know who I serve, I'm sure not going to ask the prince of this world who I serve, because he's already got an answer. If I can't make it very clear to anyone, right? Why do you believe what you believe? Who do you serve? If I can't make that very clear, by default, by failure to object in a timely fashion, by presumption, I serve the wrong master. Same thing goes for our families. So be aware of it. And pay a special attention at this time. Okay. We got a couple more minutes. I see the comments on the screen from Jeff. Appreciate that. So if there are some questions that I haven't already addressed, I'm trying to address as many as I can kind of preemptively. I do want to read one thing from Psalm 2 because it's another one of the places where all of this stuff kind of helps to fit together. I suspect all of you have heard this before. But again, these are all things that make this point so clear. Psalm 2 says, why do the heathen rage? And imagine, the people imagine a vain thing. The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against Yahuwah and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder. You know those bands of the Constitution? All those bands of the law that we've been teaching them is done away with. Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. Yahuwah shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill in Zion. I'll declare the decree. Yahuwah hath said unto me, writes the psalmist, you are my son, and this day I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I shall give you the heathen for your inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. So be wise now, therefore, O you kings, be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve Yahuwah with fear, rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry. A lot of the Christians will quote this. Sometimes it's capitalized. Sometimes it's not. Depends on which version of the thing you're reading. The original's not capitalized. lest you perish from the way when his wrath is kindled, but a little. Blessed are they that put their trust in him. That one's not capitalized in the version that I'm looking at. It should be. Because we're still talking about the same master, folks. Any way you slice it. But the other point here is those kings of the universe, those that see themselves as masters of the universe, kings of the earth, and who they serve. We're at the point now where this stuff is, again, where it's coming to a head. So, I'm going to summarize it this way, just going back to the thing from today. In this portion, we got lots and lots of detail of all these aspects of this construction. The master is in the details. And we saw this concept of, no, it's not a cult. It's things that our Creator has hidden for us. Tis to the glory of God, for him to hide a thing, and for the honor of kings, and for those who would be kings and princes, those who would be overcomers, those who would be his servants, to search it out. To show yourselves approved. Diligently seek him. So, it's been hidden, and yet it's in plain sight at the same time. It's the depth of the details that reveal him. And there's a picture here, and the picture is a real dramatic contrast, again, that difference, between the things that we can see here in this tabernacle, his set-apart dwelling, on the one hand, and I guess what I'll suggest to you is a whole different tabernacle, a different set-apart dwelling that people are going to see on Sun God Day, with a different master, and a different set of law, and different instructions. It's all about who will serve. And it's not going to be any more clear than it's going to be. Well, yeah, it will be. It's going to get continually more clear to the point where all of us are truly without excuse. So be watching and be ready and be prayerful. I know there are people actually going to be fasting through what's coming. I don't have a problem with that at all. Maybe a great idea. But whatever you do, watch and know the season and make very, very sure that you know who you serve. And there's a time to take an offering. Speak to the children of Israel that they take for me an offering of every man whose heart makes him willing. Take my offering. Let us give our offerings. Let it be a blessing. Okay, got some questions. Let's see if we can answer those. Okay, we got several websites that I've said we would post, and we'll try to get those up. One was the Grammy Award website. It's this one, and I can probably do that while we're posting. Another one is the website address for the last night's Torah portion, teaching from Shabbat Shalom Mesa, and that's up on Way to Zion. So maybe if Whistler's on, Whistler might be able to post that link. He always posts it when we're down here anyway. We'll get the website link up for the Grammy thing with the pictures in it too. Somebody's asking about the halftime show. Honestly, I haven't paid any attention. I'm sure it'll be something really, really evil. I mean, we wouldn't want to be disappointed, would we? Question from Ray King. What do you say? Why do you say watch what happens on the first day with the not-so-Super Bowl? Okay. So why do I say watch with the Super Bowl? The TSA's there, and they're asserting their strong-arm tactics. There's going to be snipers in the stands, all that kind of stuff. Do I think that a false flag event will happen? I'm not a prophet. I'm not going to make predictions. I will say to you that I won't be surprised either way. I mean, literally, I'd say it's almost a coin flip at this time. Had there been some economic news, and we might not have seen it yet, had there been a major economic meltdown, a default on the COMEX, or a failure to deliver on some of the other global markets, or any number of things that would represent a real time to pull the plug on the economic charade, I think we'd have seen a false flag for sure. Literally, I think it's the kind of thing that you can just kind of set your clock by. When you get, and I've said this, you've probably heard me say it 100 times, on the day when you see the economic meltdown and the average person on the street finally wakes up and says, Shazam, they've been lying to us all this time. There was no recovery at all. On that day, you will see World War III begin in earnest. Clinton bombed an aspirin factory the day that he was impeached. Remember that? This will be worse. What Paul Craig Robertson, another interview, I didn't even do it, but I'll mention it. He was asked, what is the biggest danger facing the world today? He said the biggest danger is the drive in Washington for world hegemony, because it brings up the real probability of a nuclear war. I don't think the Russians and Chinese, continued the former assistant treasury sec, are going to roll over for Washington and accept Washington's hegemony. That's the biggest danger. But the biggest financial danger is the collapse of the dollar as a world reserve currency. That, by the way, folks, is a guaranteed is going to happen. We just don't know when. That would bring about a far greater crisis than the collapse of the three or four big banks. And that's the choice he's saying. Choose. Collapse of the dollar, collapse of the big banks. So that's what the Fed has to figure out. Can it save the banks without bringing the dollar down? If the world reserve currency collapses, payments mechanisms everywhere is disrupted, and the reserves of the central banks evaporate. The panic that would result, the domestic inflation in the United States, we're already seeing aspects of that, right? The gas and so forth, the coming shutdown of the power grid, at least in part with brownouts and higher prices. All of this kind of thing, he says, dwarfs the crisis of having J.P. Morgan, Citibank, and a couple of others, two or three, fail. Because when the big banks fail, they just reorganize. And the deposits are very small compared to the bailouts that have already happened. So, basically, that kind of puts all this stuff in perspective. The point is, it's now Shabbat. So far as we're aware, that collapse hasn't happened. So there's not quite the need to pull the plug. But on the other hand, Super Bowl's a really big deal. If you're a terrorist, whether you're a government-paid terrorist, by government-paid I mean U.S., Washington government-paid terrorist, or a Soviet-paid terrorist, or a Chinese-paid terrorist, or an Iranian-paid terrorist, or you name it. You know, pick an entity. There's all kinds of reasons that people might want to make a statement at that high profile of an event. And you can picture a dozen different ways that it would be sold and spun. But all of them, right? It's the nature of the Hegelian dialectic. All of them mean more power for Big Brother. Anything happens at the Super Bowl, it means one and only one thing. It's not going to mean the TSA says, oops, we couldn't prevent it. We failed. All of our snipers, all of us didn't do any good. Uh-uh. It's going to mean more. More power, more power, more power, period. You peons, you thought we were tough on you before, but obviously we haven't been tough enough. Just wait. Other shoes fixing to drop. So all of those things are out there. Again, I'm not going to predict what's going to happen, but I do think that we're at one of these cusp or tipping point times. By the way, if this one doesn't get it, we got one coming up in Sochi, right? At the Russian Olympics. Is it Sochi? Did I get the wrong name? Anyway, wherever the Russian Olympics, Winter Olympics are coming up in just another month or so, and there's already lots to talk about making a show there. The article I just quoted from Now, Ray King, I can post that one because I just had it on my screen. This is from King World News, and I quote King World News frequently. They're a good group. They got some very good people. So here's the King World News story from Paul Craig Roberts. You'll find the other stories up on that same website with Roberts and with people like Michael Pinto and Jim Woolley and others that I quote all the time are up in places like that as well. Yeah, it is SOCHI, Russian Olympics, Winter Olympics coming up. Ultimately, it doesn't matter whether it happens. Well, it does. I mean, it does matter whether it happens now or later. The later it happens, the more time those of us who are aware have to prepare for it. But the thing that I keep coming back to and emphasizing is just how dramatic what is going on is and just how in your face it is. Whether it's economics or police state or the satanic rituals, the idolatry that is right out there. And it's been clear for a long time. The one God whose name you shall not mention in the public schools, Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. You can't even say God or Lord or mention the Ten Commandments in a public building or place anymore. That's where we're at. But you can have, literally, ceremonies to Baphomet on national TV, and that's okay. What can I say? I mean, how much more dramatic can all this be? So, let's close in prayer. Did I miss any questions? Let me ask that first, and then we'll close in prayer. Post a website, first day Super Bowls, more on the website. Okay, I apologize. Sometimes I have missed them, and I'll usually look afterwards, and I'll find that I missed a question or two. So if you've got something, just put a cue on the screen and then tell me that it's going to be recopied, and I'll pause and before we go. But we've got just a couple more minutes, so I want to make sure that we do close in prayer. because I think it's a time to pray. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad. Abba, Father, our King, our Creator, we thank you. We praise your holy name, your Kadosh, your set-apart name. Help us to set apart a place for you, Father, to rebuild, in whatever way it is that you would lead us, that place for you on your set-apart time, on the Shabbat. We thank you for this chance to come together, to let iron sharpen iron, to hear your word, to ask questions, to praise your name. We pray, Father, that you'd show us the things you'd have us see and know. And help us to set apart whatever else we need to set apart in these times, because it's hard. We know that. We look around at the world and we see the things that are just so undeniable. And yet there are people that do deny them. And Father, we know that in some of the... we love these people, Father. And it hurts us very deeply to see them being led not only astray, but to destruction, to death. We know that there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is the way of death. So we pray, Father, that those that we love, those that you love, that you would chasten, that your hand would be heavy upon them, and that you would help us, send them witnesses. Let us be witnesses for those who do fall into that category, for our own family and our own mishpocha, those we love, and those that others love, that we love. Help us, Father, to build that set-apart place for you. Help us to be found doing your work through whatever lies ahead. Help us to be ready. Help us to know the times and the seasons. And Abba, we pray that you would give us eyes to see and ears to hear. That you would protect us and guide us, that we would veer neither to the right nor to the left, in spite of all the deception that we know and that we can see that's so incredible. Help us to walk in your ways. Help us to be pleasing to you. Help us to be good and faithful servants to you. We thank you, Father. We praise you. We pray that you would save, protect, deliver from the hands of the adversary, deliver from rebellion, all of those others. Bring our houses together. Bring our communities together. Father, there are those who are in what they would call law enforcement. Some of them would say they're protecting and serving. We thank you for those. We pray that you would protect and guide those who have taken an oath before you. Show them your truth. Show them what you expect of them. Show them when they're serving the wrong master. Give them your guidance. Help them to come out. And through all of this, Abba, we pray again that you would give us your protection and that you would bring us out. Help us to touch not the unclean thing, to be ready for what lies ahead, and to be found where you would have us, doing what you would have us doing. All this we ask in your name. Hallelujah. Amen. Okay, I don't think I see any other questions. So again, Shabbat Shalom. And may Yahuwah bless you and keep you. May Yahuwah make his face to shine upon you. May Yahuwah lift up his countenance and give you his shalom. And finally, we say to Jeff, I know he's got to travel, and I know this has been a difficult time. So Father, we pray that you'd give Jeff your protection, your guidance, and that you would bless him and Lisa. Let this be a time of shalom. Give them your comfort. Bring them safely home. And if there are some divine appointments that you have for them along the way, let that be true as well. Use them in accord with your will for your purposes. This we ask in your name. Hallelujah. Amen. Never will I go back. I have found my way. Called by my Father, I am here to stay. As long as I'm obedient and listen to his words, diligently study, then I will be heard. Depart from the wicked and their evil ways. Don't be partakers. Come out of her, my people. That's what he told me. Is it a
We stand before him, Yahshua.